On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Monday. Beautiful Monday. Merciful Monday. Monday has arrived. It's another brand new week of liberal media on the horn. And aren't you happy? I'm happy. Of course, last night was something very, very special. Ferg and I enjoyed an absolutely magnificent time down in Charleston. Him getting his first rock concert. Me, my first trucker show in myself. Had a lovely conversation with Patterson Hood after the show. And Ferg was on something that you've heard of. He was on Cloud 9. No. Ferg was on something that takes a lot more than simple math to calculate. And he and I will talk about it here in a little bit. We've also got something that I hope is going to work out and happen coming up about the bottom of the hour. And that is that we've got a guest coming along. And it's going to be one of those little groundbreaking international conversations that we've become so fond of. We're going to be joined at the bottom of the hour By Chi Soon Wan. Chi Soon Wan is a political dissident in one of the harshest, most repressive regimes on earth, namely Singapore. Of course, President Obama just recently further legitimized Singapore's repression by attending the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit there. And I really do have to thank the Singaporeans for not putting President Obama in a pagliacci suit or the little dotted pajamas that somebody put George Bush in. These were simply little silk tunics of varying muted colors, and it's, well, I'm just grateful. But that's about as far as my gratitude extends. Singapore is a magnificent place, a beautiful place, an amazing food culture, a culture that represents a emerging and amalgam of just about all the, it's kind of a crossroads for all the ethnicities of the Asian region. And in that place, there is a government as repressive, as I said, as any on the planet. Chi Soon Wan has been jailed frequently. He has been harassed. He has been driven into bankruptcy. All because he had the unmitigated gall to challenge the ruling elite and its leader, Lee Kuan Yew. Now, by the way, Lee Kuan Yew was recently welcomed into the Oval Office. Let's see. Who agrees with me? Well, let's see. Amnesty International does. The legal system there has been condemned by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch. And if you can imagine, because of the fact that he dares to criticize the government, Chi Soon Wan is not allowed to leave the country. If you say something bad about the government in Singapore, you are sued for defamation and driven into bankruptcy. As Chee Soon Juan and his Singapore Democratic Party have been done. Among other things, it has been said that this climate continues to stifle freedom of expression, deters the expression of views alternative to those of the ruling People's Action Party, and dissuades many Singaporeans from exercising their right to take part in public affairs. This is, this is less than inspiring, and I rather wish that we wouldn't legitimize it. Because, you know, we had 8 years, did we not? 8 tormented, tortured, agonizing, misspent years of the Bush administration running brutally around the planet, supporting dictatorships, supporting repressive regimes. Wouldn't it be good to sort of turn that around? I mean, just saying. But no, they were legitimized. I hate that. Something else that came out of, and this is distressing, something else that came out of the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit meeting. We've decided to punt on climate change. Let's see. Yesterday, in the NFL, New England coach Bill Belichick decided not to punt, and it cost him. There are times you should punt. But we have decided, when we ought not, to punt on climate change. The language specifically from the New York Times is as follows, Dateline Singapore. President Obama and other world leaders have decided to put off the difficult task of reaching a climate change agreement at a global climate conference scheduled for next month, agreeing instead, those are the ones that bite you in the ass, aren't they? Instead, to make it the mission of the Copenhagen conference, to reach a less specific, politically binding agreement that would punt the most difficult issues into the future. See, I didn't say punt. They said punt. And that's the New York Times. A less specific, politically binding agreement that would punt the most difficult issues into the future. Apparently there was a hastily organized breakfast there at the APEC summit Sunday morning. And it was attended by folks like Lars Loke Rasmussen, the Prime Minister of Denmark, and the chairman of the climate conference in Copenhagen. And he and others agreed that in order to salvage the meeting at Copenhagen, my God, it's still 2 or 3 weeks away, and they're already salvaging it. It hasn't even happened yet, and it's already getting salvaged. Wow! Am I the only one that finds that a little bit off-putting? That it hasn't started and it's got to be salvaged? Gee, I wonder who's tanking it. Oh, wait. Oh. This just in. That's us! We're tanking it! The Tom Coburns and the Jim Inhofes and the Robert Byrds and the John Rockefellers and the chinless Mitch McConnells and the Jim Demented's and the people out there, well, you know, and the Joe Liebermans. You know, because remember, Joe Lieberman doesn't want us to have health care, doesn't want every American to be able to go to the doctor, because he's afraid it'll ruin, that would ruin the economic recovery. So too, I suppose, with climate change legislation. And we can't have all these green jobs popping up everywhere and ruining the economy. So as it turns out, they have already said, as of yesterday, Sunday, that the world can wait a few more months to begin getting more serious about the persistent and constant threat to the continued existence of life on Earth. Yeah, I know. Doesn't do me any good either. Imagine that. The language of the article? They would have to push a fully binding legal agreement down the road, possibly to a second summit meeting in Mexico City later on. Well, I suppose there's a little bit of ironic goodness in that. Mexico City is one of the most polluted places on planet Earth. The smog in Mexico City is god-awful, to say the least. Because it sits in the Valley of Mexico, in Quemanahuac, in the heart of the one world, as the people who raised the most brilliant civilization in existence at the time on the entire planet in that Valley of Mexico. They called it the heart of the one world. They lived sustainably, of course, and more brilliantly than their nose-picking, butt-scratching European conquerors. The hillsides surrounding Mexico City were forested. A magnificent lake flowed or sat in the area that provided a tremendous, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. Civilization, city civilization, with food, with water. They dealt with their waste issues. And they fed their people better than anybody else on the planet at the time, except for other cultures there in the Americas. The Spaniards came in, chopped down all the trees, dried up the lake. Lake Texcoco, by the way. And began turning it into a hellhole. And it is indeed that now. As much as I would, oh God, I can't begin to tell you how I'd love to go down and see the antiquities of Mesoamerica. It really is high on the bucket list, so to speak. But that's where we will find out if we're going to get serious about climate change, is in a city that was is an absolute microcosm of man's ability to change climate and to change for the worse his and her surroundings. Michael Froman is the Deputy National Security Advisor for the International Economic Affairs. He said there was an assessment by the leaders that it is unrealistic to expect a full internationally legally binding agreement could be negotiated between now and Copenhagen, which starts in 22 days. I don't think the negotiations have proceeded in such a way that any of the leaders thought it was likely that we were going to achieve the final agreement in Copenhagen, and yet thought that it was important that Copenhagen be an important step forward, including with international impact. And we can't reach that agreement because of, again, just saying, us. Oh, what was it that was said by some bizarre, sick, twisted, pudding-brained right-winger some time back? Maybe it was Michelle Bachmann. With that many adjectives, it kind of has to have been. The climate will be fine. God will protect it. Yeah. Oh, and speaking of which, of course, Godzilla from Wasilla's new book is out, otherwise known as Bible Spice, otherwise known as Sarah Palin, going rogue. And it's just, it's just chock-a-block with comedic goodness. It's astonishingly bad. And, you know, among other things, she makes clear, yeah, stop the presses for this one, that she does not believe in evolution. Yeah, I know. Hard to imagine, isn't it? She says, she talks about creationism and says, she didn't believe in the theory that human beings, thinking, loving beings, originated from fish that sprouted legs and crawled out of the sea, don't you know? Or from monkeys who eventually swung down out from the trees, golly darn, gosh, gee willikers. Yeah, no evolution. Sarah, well, I can't stand to ever miss an opportunity to run the official prophet of the Head On Radio Network. So, Sarah Palin, this is for you.
Fundamentalist Christianity, fascinating. These people actually believe the world is 12,000 years old. Swear to God. Based on what? I asked them. Well, we looked at all the people in the Bible and we added them up all the way back to Adam and Eve. Their ages, 12,000 years. Well, how fucking scientific. Okay. I didn't know that you'd gone to so much trouble there. That's good. You believe the world's 12,000 years old?
That's right.
Okay, I got one word to ask you. One word question. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Dinosaur. You know, the world's 12,000 years old and dinosaurs existed, and they existed in that time. You think it would have been mentioned in the fucking Bible at some point. And oh, Jesus and the disciples walked to Nazareth, but the trail was blocked by a giant brontosaurus with a splinter in his paw. And oh, the disciples did run a shrieking, "What a big fucking wizard, Lord!" But Jesus was unafraid, and he took the splinter from the brontosaurus' paw, and the big lizard became his friend. And Jesus sent him to Scotland, where he lived in a lock for oh so many years, inviting thousands of American tourists to bring their fat fucking families and their fat dollar bills. And oh, Scotland did praise the Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. But get this. I actually asked one of these guys, okay, dinosaur fossils, how does that fit into your scheme of life? Let me sit down and strap in. He says, dinosaur fossils? God put those here to test our faith. Thank God I'm strapped in right now here, man. I think God put you here to test my faith, dude. You believe that?
Yeah, so Sarah Palin, that's it. Sarah Palin has been put here to test our faith, and we're all strapped in, right? Right. I hope so. I hope so. And then there's this, as we cruise toward the bottom of the hour in our conversation with Chi-Sun Won, which I hope will happen. Then there's this. I want to share something with you. It is from The Onion. And all of us being rational sorts of people, we understand that The Onion is satire and humor and really, really funny sometimes. But I'm honestly afraid that The Onion's going to go out of business. David in Tennessee sent this along to me and said, I would think seriously about reading this on the air. And, yeah. After I was done, I was like, how do I not? Because I've got a story to juxtapose this with that sort of, I don't know, maybe it'll make clear why I'm afraid that The Onion's going to go out of business. And my thesis being that right-wing, the bizarre, twisted sickness, that it's becoming more and more difficult, as I have asserted on this program in times past, becoming more and more difficult to ascertain the difference between satire and reality. And we have no one other than the right wing to thank for that. Hence this. Headline, Area Man Passionate Defender of What He Imagines Constitution to Be. spurred by an administration he believes to be guilty of numerous transgressions, self-described American patriot Kyle Mortensen, 47, is a vehement defender of ideas he seems to think are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution and principles that brave men have fought for and died for solely in his head. "Our very way of life is under siege," said Mortensen, whose understanding of the Constitution derives not from a close reading of the document, but from talk show pundits, books by television personalities, and the limitless expanse of his own colorful imagination. "It's time for true Americans to stand up and protect the values that make us who we are." According to Mortensen, an otherwise mild-mannered husband, father, and small business owner, the most serious threat to his fanciful version of the 222-year-old Constitution is the attempt by far-left traitors to strip it of its religious foundation. Right there in the preamble, the authors make their priorities clear. One nation under God, said Mortensen, attributing to the Constitution a line from the Pledge of Allegiance, which itself did not include any reference to a deity until 1954. Well, there's a reason they put that right there at the top. Men like Madison and Jefferson were moved by the ideals of Christianity and wanted the United States to reflect those values as a Christian nation, continued Mortensen, referring to the father of the Constitution, James Madison, considered by many historians to be an atheist, and Thomas Jefferson, an Enlightenment-era thinker who rejected the divinity of Christ and was in France at the time the document was written. The words on the page speak for themselves. According to sources who have read the nation's charter, the U.S. Constitution and its 27 amendments do not contain the word God or Christ. Mortensen said his admiration for the loose assemblage of vague half-notions he calls the Constitution has only grown over time. He believes that each detail he has pulled from thin air, from prohibitions on sodomy and flag-burning to mandatory crackdowns on immigrants, to the right of citizens not to have their hard-earned income confiscated in the form of taxes, has contributed to making it the best framework for governance since the Ten Commandments. And let's not forget that when the Constitution was ratified, it brought freedoms to every single American, Mortensen said. Mortensen's passion for safeguarding the elaborate fantasy world in which his conception of the Constitution resides is greatly respected by his like-minded friends and relatives, many of whom have been known to repeat his unfounded assertions verbatim when angered. Still, some friends and family members remain critical. "Dad's great, but listening to all that talk radio has put some weird ideas into his head," said daughter Samantha, a freshman at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. "He believes the Constitution allows the government to torture people and ban gay marriage, yet he doesn't even know that it guarantees universal health care." Mortensen told reporters that he'll fight until the bitter end for what he roughly supposes the Constitution to be. He acknowledged, however, that it might already be too late to win the battle. "The freedoms our founding fathers spilled their blood for are vanishing before our eyes," Mortensen said. "In under a year, a fascist socialist regime has turned a proud democracy into a totalitarian state that will soon control every facet of American life." "Don't just take my word for it," Mortensen added. "Try reading a newspaper or watching the news sometime." Anybody who thinks that that is just satire, that that is just fiction, that that's just a funny little thing, raise your hand. Just like Romper Room, through the magic of the Internet, I can see all of you out there. I see Lottie, and I see Sue, and I see John, and I see Agnes. Yes, there's Agnes. And none of you have your hands up, oddly enough. Because it's real. Now, I'm not saying this story is real. I mean, it's The Onion, for God's sake. But this is a sort of archetypal social reality. Because, you know, we all know a Mr. Mortensen. I can't tell you the number of times when I'm out driving around this once lovely state. And Agnes has been with me on some of these little trips. When I'll say, honey, I'm going to follow this ass into the parking lot and straighten him up. No, Bob, keep driving. Bob, if you follow him into that Walmart parking lot, you and me are going to have a problem. Because one of these idiots, and I see them all, I mean, they're all over the place. They must have been handed out at the Second Baptist Church and Herpetological Park and Seminary at some point in time. Just a black bumper sticker with bold white letters. This is a Christian nation! And yeah, okay, granted, Agnes is sitting next to me to help deal with getting the interview lined up in a couple of minutes. But there's no getting around it. I have a confession to make. Sometimes when she hasn't been with me, I've pulled up even with one of those Christian nation cars and talking with both hands and driving with my knees turned to them, just, this is not a Christian nation! This is not a Christian nation! But we've got an entire segment of the population that thinks that is happy to define the Constitution as something that happens within the fulminations of their poor and tormented brains. But now, as we move toward the conversation at the bottom of the hour, the counterpoint to the Onion piece. Headline: Senate bill would allow mentally incapacitated vets to buy guns. This is real news. This is reality. Major Nidal Hassan, accused of killing 13 people at Fort Hood Army Base, has been described by former colleagues as psychotic. As more details emerge about Hassan's troubled state, gun safety advocates are launching fresh attacks on a Senate bill they say would make it easier for mentally unstable veterans to buy firearms. Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina, says his Veterans Second Amendment Protection Act will protect veterans' gun rights. But the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence calls it a dangerous proposal that could allow over 100,000 mentally incapacitated or incompetent persons to buy guns, people who would previously have been barred from doing so by the Veterans Administration. By the way, if you're thinking this is just some weird right-wing measure, oh, you lose. This piece of stupidity is also co-sponsored by Democratic Senator from Virginia, Jim Webb. And when the Brady Center criticized this bit of ought-to-be satire idiocy, Burr decided to attack. He said that Brady Center President Paul Helmke was using the Fort Hood tragedy to exploit the senseless murder of American soldiers in the quest to secure personal triumph.
What, Edith, huh?
Bless his heart, Helmke responded. It is hardly exploitative to have an honest debate about the proposal, which would cancel out key provisions of the Gun Control Act of 1968 and override standards used by the VA for nearly four decades. God, this is like an argument between Spock and a Klingon in the fit of some unpronounceable war ritual.
You are a coward.
It is necessary that we protect society, sir.
I loathe you, and I spit on you, and I will eat your organs.
So do you see what I'm getting at? This is reality, and what I just read to you from The Onion is funny fiction. When it ought to be the other way around. Can you imagine anything more lunatic, any more insane than putting a bill out there? Hey, let's let the veterans who've had their brains scrambled in George Bush's war of choice come home and buy more guns. So that when they wake up in a dead sweat at 3 o'clock in the morning and they're sure that they hear somebody outside the wire, then they can get their gun that they just bought at the Walmart and go out and blow away Mr. Simmons, who's walking his dog early before he has to go to work. Holy cow. It's astonishing to contemplate. And that's not, you know, that's just a smattering of what we have coming at us this evening. Another brilliant piece of satire coming our way maybe here in an hour or so. Also, the concert report from Horn intern Junior Grade Ferg. But right now, on the line with us is, in fact, as promised earlier, Singaporean activist and opposition leader, Chee Soon Juan. And I want to get right to the conversation because I sincerely appreciate his taking time to join us for this conversation. Mr. Chee, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, thank you very much for joining us. I know it's taken some time to get things squared away and settled down and make this conversation happen, but I've really been looking forward to it, and I appreciate you being up so early in the morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Let's start just with a rundown. What did you think of President Obama's recent appearance there in your country?
Well, I think it was tremendously disappointing that he didn't address some of the very gross human rights violations and the repression here in Singapore. He was here basically to be talking trade and cooperation, economic cooperation amongst the Asia-Pacific countries. It is disappointing that he didn't see fit to at least raise human rights issues because really, human rights and economic rights, they're one and the same. They're both sides of the same coin because one without the other just cannot make a democratic capitalist society function to the best of its ability.
Is it a case where we see some sort of a dichotomy in that, it seems to me that where we go in search of economic well-being, human rights are the first thing to go.
Yes, because, you know, people, you know, business see it, human rights. That includes workers' rights, of course, and then, you know, your labor unions and trade unions. They see it as a hindrance to them generating maximum profit. And this is where, you know, where they go and where governments are able to keep these rights at bay, keep workers from organizing, from having a voice in society, in the workplace. That's all the better for them. They can just do as they please. But they don't realize that something like that is not sustainable, and it's not speculation on my part. It's happened before in other economies where workers' rights, human rights are suppressed by dictators. And when the economy starts to unravel, as it inevitably will, because there's no transparency and accountability, governments get corrupt, nothing is brought up to the surface, and everything just crumbles in the end. And so I was just hoping that at least President Obama could at least be able to make that connection there and say these both sides of the argument just as important.
Well, you know, to be quite honest, Singapore, for many people, I suspect, is not one of the countries that we think about most when we think of repressive regimes. That dishonor tends to go to places like Myanmar. But describe for the listeners, if you would please, sir, what you're talking about when you say repression in Singapore.
You know, you're right in that sense that when people think of Singapore, repression is not the first thing that comes to mind. But when I tell you that we have laws such as the Internal Security Act, which allows the government to detain citizens without trial and on an indefinite basis, we have had political prisoners, and I'm talking about elected members of parliament that have been detained without trial for as long as the longest serving political prisoner in Singapore is 32 years. Let me put that into perspective. Nelson Mandela was in prison for only 27 years, and he was given a trial. This person, this Singaporean that was detained for, who was detained for 32 years, did not get a trial, was never charged for anything at all. If you visit our website today, you'll see this other political prisoner, the second longest serving prisoner, who was detained for 20 years without ever given a trial. And these are things people don't know about. We have another law, it's called the Public Order Act, which was just passed a few months ago, and specifically because Mr. Obama was coming for this summit over this weekend. And this law states that not a single person, a lone individual, can protest, can even conduct a protest. That's the extent of the repression we have here. My colleagues and I face multiple charges for things such as distributing of pamphlets, and our charge states that it is an offense to demonstrate opposition to the actions of the government. And I'm quoting verbatim from the charge sheet. So that's the extent of the repression, and to give people an idea of the extent of the repression that we have here in Singapore that goes on here.
And of course, there's a vibrant business community in Singapore. So as you've discussed, the repression serves very well the business community, does it not?
Yes, especially for the multinational companies that work here. We have, or even to the extent that the American representative in the Chambers of Commerce sits on a board here in Singapore that determines the wage level of Singaporeans. And you know, for me, that's not a capital society. Because my idea of a capital society is that labor is free to bargain with management for the wages. But over here in Singapore, there's a board of council that sits, and that council then determines the wage levels of workers here. That is the extent, again, of the economic repression, if you will.
That is stunning to me. That sounds, forgive me, it sounds either fascist or Soviet. I'm not sure which. So there's no collective bargaining. There is no means by which a worker can use the power of the workforce itself to secure better wages?
None whatsoever. I mean, we have an umbrella trade union here, very much like what you think of as the AFL-CIO in the U.S. And this umbrella trade union is headed by a cabinet minister. It's almost like the labor secretary in the U.S. heading the AFL-CIO. But that's the extent of the situation that we have here. And we have workers here being paid, annually $5,000 U.S. dollars a year. And Singapore is a place that is as expensive as New York City and Chicago. And this is where I just cannot come to grips with this whole idea, but of political, not only political, but economic oppression as well, and that's not tenable. That's not sustainable in the long run.
Obviously, you are the leader of a political party there. Your political party has been bankrupted. You have been financially punished. What is the Singapore Democratic Party? Has the government effectively neutered it?
Yeah, I mean, there are no opposition parties here. I mean, you know, we're talking about an opposition party that is just struggling to survive. I personally have been dragged to court on three separate occasions, and this is not the criminal prosecutions, apart from those that I just mentioned earlier on. I've been sued for defamation. When we speak up and against government policies, they sue us for defamation, and I've been sued on three separate occasions already, and I've been ordered to pay a total of more than $1 million U.S. dollars. I tried to pay off some of these loans, but these damages. My wife and I, we sold off our house, our car, and all our possessions, And we couldn't make good the rest of the payment. We were always made a bankrupt. And as a bankrupt, I cannot speak in public during elections. I am banned from standing for elections, and I'm barred from leaving Singapore. My party now, the Singapore Democratic Party, has also been sued for defamation. And the party has also been ordered to pay hundreds of thousands in damages, of dollars in damages. And so that's where we stand right now, and we are staring into the barrel and of being made party being made a bankrupt and wound up.
Well, for a sense of perspective, sir, what constitutes such defamation in the eyes of the ruling party in Singapore?
Well, you know, one of the lawsuits that I went through was because it said that the government was not transparent with our public fund, with the state fund, when it had loaned billions of dollars to the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia. This was in the 1990s. And I stood up during an election rally and pointed this out. And because of that, I was sued. But what's even worse was when I tried to defend myself in the court, the court didn't allow me to have a trial because it just awarded the case to the plaintiff, who was prime minister, and I'm sorry, not the prime minister, but government leader in Singapore, and one of whom was the prime minister, and I was just made to pay these damages even without trial.
Is this sort of governmental repression? Is it accompanied by? What I would consider brutal police tactics as well?
Yes, I mean, you have this whole, a nexus of laws that will not allow us even to have peaceful, small groups of protest on the street. And every time when we come together, even just to, for a simple activity like distributing flyers, for example, we are charged for illegal assembly. And this is, there was one situation whereby we were, wanted to conduct a protest when the World Bank and IMF had a meeting here in Singapore, and that was in 2006. Well, the police basically just stopped us. And the whole horde of them just prevented us from moving, and we were held on the sidewalk, for nonstop for 3 days, and we weren't allowed to move or go, to proceed with our activity. And that would set the extent of the state action that the police would take.
You have mentioned that Singapore is a very expensive place to live, and you have mentioned that many Singaporeans live on less than $5,000 U.S. per year. What percentage of the Singaporean population, if you know, sir, is in desperate straits?
Oh, there is a significant layer of underclass that people don't see. Of the homeless, the destitute. The only difference here in Singapore is that the government is very efficient at cleaning up the street. In other words, there is a unit, for example, that goes around on a bi-monthly basis and goes around and gets to some of these destitute homeless people, round them up, and put them in halfway houses. And it's just that kind of situation where it's out of sight, out of mind. But it doesn't mean that these people don't exist. It's just that the government is very much more efficient in making sure that the public doesn't see, or at least the international community doesn't see, some of these underclass people that exist in Singapore.
Just as background, how did you come into this struggle? How did you come to this controversy? What was your upbringing? Your training? Your teaching? Your life.
You know, I did my undergraduate and my graduate studies in the U.S. And in psychology, it didn't have very much to do with politics, really. But when I came home and I saw what was going on, that the people did not have a voice, and the people who were voiceless were downtrodden and didn't have a say in their society, and I just felt it was not something that I wanted to live with and to put up and just keep my head bowed and not say anything about it. And so I joined the opposition, and at that time, when I returned from the U.S., I was teaching at the university over here, and within months of joining the opposition, I was dismissed and subsequently sued and you know, for defamation. But that was something that really made it I don't regret it. I don't. Absolutely not, because it was something that I feel that ought to have been done, and I'm glad that I did it. But it's something that I don't want to have to continue to put up with, and that's why it's important for us to speak up and actively work towards the system's demise.
Singapore's leader, Lee Kuan Yew, has been in office how long? How consolidated is his power base?
Well, since 1959, he was the president. Oh, I'm sorry, he was the prime minister for about three decades. And after he left office, he's still in the cabinet as a minister mantle, and there's no doubt that he's the paramount leader. Currently, his son is a prime minister. His daughter-in-law, the prime minister's wife, has been put in charge of the state fund, I think we call it the sovereign wealth fund, that goes around and invests in, globally in all kinds of institutions and all, you know, in all business ventures. And the whole thing is that the decisions are kept within these three persons, and no one, no Singaporean knows, the government won't reveal where these funds are being invested, how they're being used, and it's this kind of non-transparency and accountability that is, you know, it's absurd. I mean, we've lost hundreds of billions of dollars when we invested in Citibank, Citigroup, and Merrill Lynch that went, you know, belly up. And you know, no one is held accountable, and we still don't know how these funds are being used all over the world.
So for all intents and purposes, with some sort of a governmental veneer, we're talking about a country that is basically ruled by a hereditary oligarchy at this point?
Well, yeah, it's very much, you know, within the family still, because, as I said, Lee Kuan Yew, the father, is still, his title is Minister Mantor. That's his official title. And his son is the Prime Minister. And, you know, it's something that, I think no democratic society would want to see, especially if there are, free and fair elections, which there aren't in Singapore. Our election here could not be any more, unfree and unfair. Everything is controlled by the Prime Minister's office. And, you know, we have people that are still absolutely terrified of voting for the opposition.
And with given the tactics that you have described in the way of harassment of the opposition, one is hard-pressed to even put opposition candidates on the ballot, I would assume. Is that correct?
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. I mean, in past elections, we have so too much difficulty just trying to get candidates, people to join the party and offer them as candidates. At every election, come election, the opposition cannot field more than half of the seats that are up for grabs in parliament. And so, you know, even before the first vote is cast, the ruling party is returned to power. And then they make threats to citizens, saying that, well, if you don't vote for us, your precinct, your housing estate will not get public funds to get your public facilities upgraded. You won't get your libraries. You won't get your schools. You won't get your public transport. And that's the extent of the kind of threats that they will go to intimidate the voters.
So Singapore has this reputation of being a very peaceful, orderly place. If I understand correctly, you are suggesting that that is something that is achieved via strict suppression of any of the fundamental urges toward basic human being.
When you look at Nazi Germany, I mean, the trains ran on time, the places were clean, crime rate was low. How has it got to do with the fact that this really wrong thinking that somehow you need a dictatorship to be able to keep the streets clean and orderly. I've seen very many cases that I've been to that are just as orderly and just as tidy. I mean, look at some of the cities in Canada and the U.S. and in Australia. But at the same time, people are free to, you know, to express their view. This is where I feel that there is this misconception that somehow you need an authoritarian regime to be able to keep the place neat and tidy and so on. I remember President Kennedy had said that, you know, you have the security of a graveyard. Is that really what people really want?
How did it come to this? What was the genesis of this restrictive authoritarian regime? Is it something that arises out of the Second World War? Or is it of newer vintage than that?
Well, before World War II, we were a British colony. That is, for ages, we were a British colonial outpost. And when we gained independence, Lee Kuan Yew came into power, and he was the poster boy. I mean, at that time, the British loved him because he espoused all the values that, you know, a liberal government would do. But the minute he came to power, he closed the door and he put grease down the pole, if you will, and made it impossible for the opposition to exist and crack down and detain all his opponents without trial. And from there on, democracy didn't stand a chance, and that system has gone on for more than half a century already, and we haven't seen any signs of the system letting up.
If I may be so personal, Mr. Chi, given what the government has done to you, how do you and your wife survive?
You know, I've not been able to find a job since I was back from the university. I mean, I was basically trained and as an academic, doing research and teaching, and I did a lot of work in neuroscience. And since I was sacked, I've not been able to get back into the field again. I've had to write to get my to publish my books and then sell them on the streets because very few bookstores here would sell them in their stores. So you know, we've had to eat out a living and get by with, I'm not looking at. Is it something that I just had to do, and you get on with it? But the more important thing right now is for me to continue to be able to speak up for the people that don't have a voice.
Oh, here, sir. I asked the question mainly because it seems so brutally efficient to do what they have done to you, insofar as they have said you're bankrupt, so you can't run for office. We've thrown you out of your teaching and research position, and as an added bonus, we're not going to let you leave the country. So it's not just enough that they attempt to silence you; they want to make sure that they silence you in every way conceivable. Because theoretically, you could at least leave the country and go and work from outside. But even that avenue has been foreclosed to you.
Yeah, they are putting a tremendous amount of pressure on my family and I. But, you know, you don't fail when you don't succeed. You fail when you give up, and that's not something I intend to do, because it would just give them a lot of satisfaction if they see me wanting to up and leave and say it's not that I can, but it's something which I'm determined to hang on to. But you're right; it's very. It's very efficient. It's comprehensive. This kind of a repression.
Well, if you could have your way, and simply ask of the American people, the freedom loving community, for remedies for Singapore, what would it be?
You know, for the American people, just to be pragmatic and to be hard nosed about what their interests are. be surprising for me to say something like this, but to take a look at your a multinational corporation that go out into the world and do conduct business. They don't want, where they can function most effectively if there is no labor union to contend with, no workers' rights to have to worry about, they can maximize their profit and repatriate all their profit. But that, is that sustainable? Is that, you know, if you cannot, you know, kind of bully American people, you go out and bully the Asian people, the African people, and people that you can, that you can collaborate with governments to suppress. So if the American people can see this and just think of it in the long-term interest that, you know, democracy makes good economic sense, that you don't suppress workers in order to maximize profit. If the American people can see that and they continue to work towards a situation whereby the multinational corporations going out to the world to do business don't resort to such practicalism, I think that the term there is corporate social responsibility, and make sure that the ethics are adhered to as well. And that would help tremendously the American interest as well.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation your website. Would you share that with us, please?
Yes, you know, it's yoursdp.org, Y-O-U-R, S in Singapore, Democratic, D, and Party. In one word, yoursdp.org. And we try to put up as much information as possible to be able to reach out to Singaporeans as well as the international community and to kind of educate people what kind of society that Singapore is. And if you look at our website today, even today, you will find a video that shows a political prisoner that I mentioned earlier on who was incarcerated for 20 years. He's in his 80s right now. And if you hear the ordeal that he had to go through, it's heartbreaking. And I don't want, that should never happen to anyone in the world just because he wants to have some decency to be able to speak up for his fellow citizens and to have some semblance of democracy in the country. So I would urge you, if you're listening, please visit and take a look at this video and see the real Singapore for themselves instead of this whole facade that the tourist promotion board here puts on that Singapore is a clean and green society. There's this unique place there and fun place to visit.
And would something like listeners writing to their elected representatives in this country to try to educate them on the state of affairs in Singapore, would that be beneficial?
Yes, of course. The members of Congress, and just alert them to the very fact that if you wanted to continue doing business in Singapore, don't ignore these human rights, because there are people suffering, there are people having a hard time in Singapore, and it's just ignoring the human rights is akin to exploitation. That is not what I believe the U.S. wants as well. I'm right to the State Department. I get the State Department to pay attention more to the human rights violations here and the extent of the repression here, and that would certainly help not just the people, but, you know, people who don't have a voice here in Singapore.
Do you have any reason to think or hope or believe that any sort of private communication was had between the ruling elite in Singapore and the Obama administration when he visited?
No, I think all signs indicated that the administration, U.S. officials, were just not interested at this stage in wanting to have anything to do with human rights. I think Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was here for quite a few days. And I, to my knowledge, I don't think there was any opportunity that she had had to meet up with not just the opposition, but even civil society. So, you know, I don't think there's any interest at this stage, which is a shame, and it's very short-sighted.
Well, I find it at the very least a little bit ironic that President Obama spoke in the People's Republic of China today and spoke about urging the Chinese government to relax its so-called Great Firewall of China to allow greater Internet access for its people, and yet would have remained so sadly quiet In Singapore, frankly, the Chinese exercise a great deal more control over our own economy than Singapore does. Is this strictly a matter of corporatism then?
I think it is. I think because Singapore is the place for a lot of corporations, global corporations that are headquartered here. I'm not sure whether that was the reason or not, but certainly I don't think there was any discussion on human rights, or at least it wasn't made public. But what's the point of really talking about human rights when it's not made public? And this is where, I don't understand. But, you know, again, we're not saying that human rights issues should be the front and center of all the discussions here in Singapore. But what we're saying is that don't ignore it. Don't just completely not discuss it, because it's as important as talking about anything else in society.
And I'm sure, well, and, you know, there's the additional question of even had the White House press corps covering the president's visit wanted to, the Singaporean government would have made it very much difficult for them to speak to a dissident such as yourself, would they not?
Oh, yes. I mean, there is a law that prohibits international media from, quote-unquote, interfering in domestic affairs. In other words, I'm interviewing people like me. And because I had given a couple of interviews to BBC and CNN and CNBC, for example, and within months, as I said, the government came out with a law to outlaw some of these media organizations, international organizations, from talking about political situation in Singapore. And you have a lot of news organizations that have been sued for defamation as well. I mean, Time, Newsweek, International Herald Tribune, you name it, Bloomberg, for example, they've all been taken to court and sued for defamation and have been made to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages to Lee Kuan Yew and some of the other government officials.
I know this may sound superfluous, but frankly, I have no fear of them. But
yes,
I did.
They will not touch you in the U.S. because, you know, they, in order to sue you, they have to go through the U.S. court. And that is not going to be something that they're willing to do, because, you know, if you defend yourself, they'll be made around things stock, and it's not something that they will even contemplate.
I know it may seem strange to say it, but it would, for those very reasons that you mentioned, it would provide a delightful opportunity to bring light to this issue, because, well, frankly, I remember the story going back, into the 90s with the caning incident with the young American man, and our right wing was saying, oh, yeah, beat him some more. That's what we need. We need to have laws like Singapore has. And all that while I was thinking, you know, this is not where we want to go. And I think the Singaporean government got a lot of bad press out of that. And what we need to do is get them some more bad press. And I really thank you very much, Mr. Chi, for joining us this evening. And I wish you all the best. I'm already getting emails from listeners wanting to know more. So we will send them to yoursdp.org, and hopefully they will learn from it and act on it. And I wish you the very best, sir. I wish you the very best.
I thank you, and thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
It was an absolute, it was a pleasure for me as well. Take care, sir.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Chi Soon Won of the SDP in Singapore. He is a persecuted political opponent of the dictatorship there. And I don't hesitate to use the word dictatorship because it is what it is. And simply putting a veneer... I'll be honest, I'm tired of this American realpolitik that says we don't care what they do as long as they agree with us. It has gotten us into a morass of almost incomprehensible the breadth and scope, that cynical approach to international relations. from how we deal with Cuba to how we deal with the People's Republic of China to how we deal with the Saudi Arabians to how we deal with repressive regimes like Uzbekistan? Is it the Uzbek leader who boils his political opponents alive? I think so. And there has to be a break with that past if, in fact, the realities of change we can believe in is to actually sink roots and send up something that can grow and thrive. I'm very grateful to Chi-Soon Won for that conversation. He lives at hazard. And it astonishes me to imagine what... No, it doesn't astonish me. It impresses me to know what people are willing to do in order to secure... What did Madison and that crowd call it? The blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity? Those are words to live by. Those are words to live by, not some corporate charter that says we hereby vow to maximize profits at the expense of human life and human dignity. So thank you to Chi-Soon Won. I do appreciate it. We will come back. I have Horn intern Junior Grade Ferg in the studio. We will talk about last night's show and many other things as well. You are listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to the Horn.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. In their speech is growing increasingly unkind. And they say they are Christ's disciples. They don't look like Jesus to me. Be like I am, living in this wasteland of the free. We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me. Living in this wasteland of free. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. They'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. Living in the
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Right at 15 minutes past the hour as we begin the second hour of tonight's program, this Monday evening program. And that was serious, heady business that we were talking with Chi-Soon Juan about. And I wanted to put a little bit of, if you can, and I'm sure you do know what I mean, I wanted to put a little bit of psychic space, if you will, between that and what we're going to do next. Because, as promised, we now have a concert report. Ferg's first concert review by horn intern junior grade Ferg. As you know, we let me do this and make everything work the way it needs to work right now. Stand by. Right, because this one's open, son.
I know that.
Okay, so don't touch the mic. Just.
I got it.
You know, there's some things that you got to reinforce, son. Don't touch the mic. you don't know. You'd have to see the chaos that is this studio to understand what I have to do to get me a microphone and him a microphone. Because once upon a time, Agnes produced from the chair that I'm in, and I used to sit over in the corner with my very unhappy little microphone. Sparky in the chat room says he sounds pumped. Oh, he is, Sparky. He is. So backstory, you know, I talked about it all evening on Friday. And we were stoked, and we stayed stoked, and it was like 48 hours of the night before Christmas for Ferg.
It was like Christmas time.
Right.
Except there's a new present.
Yeah, only it was 48 hours worth.
Yes.
So through the kind offices of David in Tennessee.
Thank you, David.
Yes.
I love you.
He does. He does. David made contact with Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers and got us put on the guest list and a pair of backstage passes. And so we went to the show last night and had excellent seats. And, okay, I don't know, what is this going to be, stream of consciousness freeform? Let's see, what'd they open with, Ferg? Ghost to Most, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure, yeah. It was awesome. It felt like the bass drum was in my soul. It blew me in. That sounded a little perverted, but it blew me away.
Yeah, it was rattling your innards.
It made me feel like it was touching my soul. I was like, ah.
Yeah, and you'll remember that Ferg is a learning drummer, a learning guitar player,
a learning piano player,
a learning keyboardist, and
learning mandolin,
a learning mandolinist. Otherwise known as the 8-string misery box.
And I want a banjo.
Yeah, he wants a banjo. He ain't getting a banjo. I told him, no, we're gonna master what we got so far.
He need to learn the banjo duel on Deliverance.
No, stop it. But anyway, they opened with Ghost to Most, followed with. I was sitting there all night long trying to memorize the set list. Oh, what was the second song?
I don't know, but it was like, I swear.
The Righteous Path. The Righteous Path. And then they went to the opening act.
Which was they dedicated it to UFO.
Yeah.
Because what they were talking about in 77.
Not they, Patterson was.
Well, Patterson, where he was in 77. On Thanksgiving weekend over at the Civic Center listening to AC/DC, who was UFO and who else, Dad?
Well, UFO was the opening act for AC/DC at the Charleston Civic Center in Charleston, yeah.
And who else was it, the Motorhead?
The main part was AC/DC and UFO.
Yeah, but he said how UFO was just as, maybe not as good anywhere else, but that night they were just as good as any other band.
Because the time that Patterson was talking about, the time frame he was talking about, he was roughly the same age as Ferg.
Bam. Yeah.
Yeah, and see, there it is in the chat room, Big Baldy in the chat room. UFO, I remember those guys. And the degree of, could you tell, Ferg, what a degree of warmth that Patterson felt for the audience?
Well, he was... I can't really explain. I've heard other people talk. He was very real. with the audience, and he felt like he could connect with them. And I mean, he just had that realistic point of view. He wasn't bull hawking us. He wasn't cutting around the chase or anything. I mean, he just went straight forward to it, and he talked about his life and how he grew up and how music helped him understand everything, and how music made him have a better life. So I mean, I think he connected with the audience pretty well through that, because I mean, so many people. I mean, I just want to be like him someday, because so many people look up to him and wish they were him or were married to him.
What I think you're recognizing, Ferg, is that the lack of artifice. It was. I don't think Ferg's ever seen This Is Spinal Tap, but it wasn't that moment when the guy walks out on stage in Detroit and says, "Hello, Cleveland." No, not at all.
And they came out with Jack Daniels and beer.
Yes, there was Jack Daniels and beer on the stage. Trust the 13-year-old to notice that.
I thought it was so awesome that they were drinking while they were playing. That's like the best.
Yeah, but you got to get real good before you can ever do that.
I know, but I don't know how they didn't get messed up. I mean, it looked like they were sweating it all out, but it looked like they were having such a grand old time up there.
They were, and that's the other thing. Nobody wants to watch a band go through the motions.
I love it.
And that was not what was going on. These guys were really into it, in part because of the fact that the last time they were here, they made an appearance on a show that goes out over, what do they call it now, American Public Media, called Mountain Stage, and it's produced every week, and then it's subsequently put out for broadcast by affiliate public radio stations. And the last time they were here, Patterson was dealing with walking pneumonia and pleurisy. And he got out on the stage, sang one song against his own better judgment, and then sort of crawled off stage and as he said last night, was afraid he was going to die.
He did. I thought it was funny how he was explaining it, especially with all the words.
Especially with all the words? What does that mean?
The words.
Oh, the fun words?
The fun words. You know, the F-U-C-K.
Hey.
Some people don't know how to spell. I mean, it's okay.
Stop it. But, well, it's a reality stage experience.
It was amazing. I mean, there's no coming back from that. It was something you can't get over. I mean, I can still feel the bass drum. And it still feels like I'm sitting in that seat.
Did you talk about it at school today?
Yes, and the teachers knew who they were. I go up to girls and say, "Hey, I went backstage on a concert." And they went, "Really? Not miss there." I went, "Okay." Went out my backstage pass, and I was like, "There you go. Proof." And then one of my best friends had said, "Oh, you didn't go backstage. You're lying." I pulled it out, and I did show and tell, and I explained everything I did, and I explained about the groupies.
He saw his first groupies last night.
And I learned a new street word.
We will leave it at that.
I know. I'm not going to say anything else about the groupies. It was so cool, though. I wish I had groupies. I need a groupie.
And at backstage in the conversation, the brief conversation we had with Patterson, he brought that up, and Patterson's response was, "Well, that's why all any of us learned to play guitar for."
It was amazing. I mean, I watched him, and all you hear is, "Patterson, I love you."
Good crowd noise, son.
I know. It's a delay effect.
So what did you get out of watching the musicians? I mean, were you just too stunned with the whole totality of the circumstance to pick up any tips, any pointers?
Well, actually, I did pick up some tips and pointers. When you drink and play, you look like you have more fun.
Okay, see, you're being shallow there. That's not the lesson you were supposed to learn.
Okay, actually, I did learn a lesson. Some of their songs really actually spoke to me. I'm not talking about just listening to the music. If you listen to the words to a couple songs, they really actually tell you some stuff, And it's a story when they sing. It's a story. Their songs aren't just somewhere like Nickelback making up some song about love or something. Their songs are a story.
Are you talking about Patterson's introduction of Let There Be Rock Show?
Yes. It was amazing. I liked it. I about cried.
What? Why?
It was just the guitar playing. I mean, the bass playing. It was, just as David said, the bass and the drums work together like two snakes making love to each other. It was just that amazing. Yeah, it's something you can't get over. You all haven't lived until you've heard the Drive-By Truckers play live. And, I mean, just the... And they didn't go into all of the pyrotechnics or anything. And I think that's also what...
What? No lasers?
No.
No smoke machines?
No. I don't think their concerts do not need that. Their songs are enough pyrotechnics, just enough. I mean, just the way, like... For instance, one of the guitar solos, I loved how they used the slide, because, I mean, it just has that, it gives you an adrenaline rush, but at the same time, it's making you calm.
See, I was surprised, the one thing I haven't heard yet, I'm still getting I Want a Banjo, given the absolute artistic perfection of the way it's played. I'm surprised I haven't gotten Dad, I Want a Pedal Steel yet.
I don't want a pedal steel. I want a banjo. Bang, 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 boing.
Oh, God, what am I going to do? I'd feel better about the pedal steel.
I need a banjo because not just anybody can play a banjo. But, I mean, back to the concert. The way the concert was set up, I mean, it's half the fun is getting there. I mean, you get twice the fun listening to the music, but half the fun is sitting there, and it gives you that, I don't know how to explain it, it's not adrenaline, and it's not excitement, it's more of a, oh my gosh, you gotta get out there and play, if you don't, I'm gonna die. It's just that, I guess you could call it anticipation, I guess.
I think what Ferg is describing is the 30 minutes or so before the show started, when every 2 minutes was... You think they're going to play soon, Dad? Are they going to start soon, Dad? Dad, when are they going to start? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and you can't control your bladder during a concert.
Oh, stop it.
No, I mean, I did, but it's, like, super hard because you get so excited, and then everything's, like...
You are not a chihuahua.
Everything's rushing around you, and you're like, You just get that little... And some of their songs, you just get a little chill up your spine.
Well, when Patterson was talking before they went into Let There Be Rock Show, and he was talking about how rock and roll showed him that there was a world outside, and he used lots of fun words.
Tons.
A world outside the petty little high school world he was living in. Did that have any meaning for you, Ferg?
Yes, it did. Matter of fact, as much of a coincidence as I thought it was today, I went back to school and they were talking about how. Sorry, my dad's talking to me real quick.
No, I'm telling you to get up on the mic.
I don't want to get up on the mic. I like relaxing. I'm a relaxed guy.
He wants to direct.
But anyways, I thought it was a coincidence how I went back to school today, and there was a quote. It was talking about rock and roll, but it was using it as more of a kid standpoint, how, like, they have to mix some stuff in quotes. You use two quotes for one. They were talking about how video games are becoming more healthy for you. People say that video games are bad for you. They said just the same about rock and roll. Rock and roll, it's a little bit more different. I took it into more of a moderation standpoint. I mean, rock and roll can teach you so many different things, and you can tell the mood by a certain rock and roll song. I mean, for instance, think of a song. I'm not going to name any songs. I'm just trying to get one in my head. Like, okay, piano songs, you can tell a different mood. Somebody's mad. Somebody's real serious, sad.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they can teach you that through a song. And I guess that can also teach you there's more to life than just this. There are so many open doors for me. I just have to walk through it. And I will be there.
What does it take, though, Ferg? What does it take?
Oh, man. Hard work, effort. You have to have your priorities and goals set in a straight line. And you gotta be willing to reach for the stars. You have to love it when you do it. You can't just do something you don't love. And
you can't wait for magic to make it happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you can go to sleep and dream about it all you want and wish upon a bunch of stars. If you don't do the hard work and you don't make the effort, that dream's never going to come true. It's just the same as now. I'm hoping I want to master the guitar and I want to master the drums. I want to form my own band, but I have to work for it and I have to make the effort, and so do the other people that are willing to make the effort with me. And yeah, I mean, it'll be a long road and a long journey, but I think I'd be willing to do it. I think it'd be a good opportunity. I'm excited to see what happens for me in the future. I mean, Patterson, he went from somebody that he even told me he went from somebody that wasn't so cool to now he's a major rock star. And people back in high school that used to make fun of him and stuff were like, "Oh, we were good buddies back then," and stuff like that. I envy him.
Well, you've got an email in from David in Tennessee. He said, when we were talking about the no need for pyrotechnics, the songs have that. David says, "Ferg, you're trying to describe fulfillment."
Fulfillment, yes.
Good live music fulfills. Bladder control urgency? That's what every performer feels and reacts to just before going on stage. That's just Ferg coming closer to his performer era. Some precursor to hitting the boards. And P.S., reach for the stars and wear your ass out in the meantime.
I'll try, David. And remember, I love you for this. I mean,
you've already got an I love you back, Ferg.
Okay. I mean, I can't thank you enough for this. I mean, you gave me an opportunity, and I took it, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And every minute that lasted, I wish I was still there. I wish I could repeat this night. Because, I mean, as much as you think, "Oh, I'm so tired and I want to go home," I was up, man, Dad, like, what, 4 or 5 hours past my curfew?
Past your bedtime.
Curfew. I like to say curfew because I'm a teenager.
No, because it's not like you're out, you know, drinking Milwaukee's best down an old dirt road somewhere. It's just a bedtime.
Milwaukee's. No.
Shut up.
But anyways, I mean, if I can become what Patterson is today, then I will have fulfilled my lifelong dream of becoming a rock star. I mean, sure. I mean, I want to pass people up. I want to go in the fast lane.
Oh dear. Okay, I'm getting the idea that now that we've got the cool front end, it's time to it's time to start talking about people like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, you know.
You see, I mean,
listen, young Skywalker, there's a dark side too.
I know there's a dark side.
The Force is strong with this one. Ferg, thanks. Go on out of here. Get your homework done.
I'm already done. I had algebra.
Well, then do more.
I don't want to do any more algebra.
No, you got to do more algebra.
It's awful.
Yes, I know it is, and it makes no sense. But the thing is, while it makes no sense to you now, there is every chance in the world that you'll wind up a balding 46-year-old.
What does PXQCS?
No, stop. There's every chance in the world you'll wind up a balding 46-year-old who thinks, you know, this algebra is pretty cool now that I've got the brain to comprehend it. So away with you, Ferg.
Good night. There's your microphone back. I love you.
Yeah, thanks. What did I say? Don't touch the microphone.
Good night, David. I love you. Love you forever.
And he really, really does. Go on. Shoo. Get. Away with you. There's something out there that you don't know that needs learning.
Everybody except me, too, including my teacher.
Goodbye. Go do scales. Do something. And there goes Horn Intern Junior Grade Ferg after his first rock and roll show. And, you know, I can't be too rough on him for not memorizing the set list. I didn't either. But, how can I put this? I was guilty of living vicariously through my son last night. Because I remember my first rock show, and I don't think it was nearly as cool as this one was. Because, among other things, I think my first rock and roll show was Pablo Cruz, okay? So just, you know, what you gonna do when she says goodbye compared to The Righteous Path? No, I think Ferg wins this round. But I was also watching him and watching him take it all in. And it was just such, it was magic. His eyes were as big as goose eggs, just catching everything from one thing to another. I don't know. He was like a spider monkey on Mountain Dew. That's all I can say. But the show report was promised and it was delivered. As a small token of thanks, we took Patterson a copy of the new book that is out. It's a coffee table book, and it's a beautiful thing. It's called Plundering Appalachia. And just as a little bit of backstory on the concert, it was held at the Clay Center, which is the big arts center in Charleston. Beautiful building. A matter of exquisite vision. But the concert series are individually sponsored. And last night's sponsor, we were told at the beginning of the program, everybody give a big round of applause to Roger Nicholson. Roger's a vice president of the International Coal Group. And it was one of those moments where I had to catch my lower lip between my teeth and bite till it hurts. To keep from hollering out, thanks, Roger, for Sago! Thanks! But, yeah, that ICG, International Coal Group. But then, in the course of the description that Ferg was talking about, where Patterson was talking about his concert experience at the Charleston Civic Center in November of 1977, and AC/DC with the warm-up act UFO, and he went on to say, you know, we were up here because for a couple of years my granddad had left home to take a job building some sort of industrial nightmare around here. He said, I think it was a refinery or something like that. And he said, and I'm sure that it's still polluting your world and just putting a lot of shit into your environment. And at that moment, it just something in my heart went, yes, yes, yes. Because as you can tell by listening to the music, I think in particular off of the album The Dirty South, Putting People on the Moon, let me know a long time ago that those guys are aware of what's going on. So Patterson seemed fairly pleased to receive that copy of Plundering Appalachia, and there are stunning stories and photography in there. A little something to look at on the bus on the way home. It was a magnificent night. If you are ever within reach of going to see a trucker's show, treat yourself. Do yourself a favor. Go see it. Because it's a rock and roll experience that is unlike anything going on out there today. Because it is A, real, B, honest, C, unpretentious, and D, genius. And if you get a chance to see it in an environment somewhat less restrictive than the Clay Center, you'll be even luckier. You know, because the Clay Center Auditorium's got like two levels of balconies and side boxes where people, where women can sit in furs with little opera glasses and stuff like that. It ain't made for rock and roll. So, anyway, we had a marvelous time, and it was just it's something that will not soon be forgotten. It's about 20 minutes before the hour, and I know we've been talking for quite some time, but let's see if there's anybody left on the lines. Nope. So we've got empty lines across the board. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. The local dialing number is 304-658-3333. That'll save us a nickel or a buck instead of going toll-free, if you wish. And, you know, share what's on your mind. Remember, you know, this is not one of those radio shows where you have to be thinking about, wrapped up in whatever issue has grabbed my attention for the time being. You can drive this bus as well as I can. Just a nice little, we had the story that, you know, that should be fake news that actually turns out to be real, that there are actual senators out there who want to put firearms in the hands of people who have profound mental illnesses. Well, a lot of those people and a lot of the shooting and killing that happens in this country is done by people who call themselves followers of the Prince of Peace. So Dallas Dem over at Daily Kos penned this the other day, and it was sent along to me. I think Dennis sent this along. Yeah, it was Dennis. And I just wanted to share it with you for a minute before we do go back to the phones. The title, The Unspoken Christian Problem in the United States. Why does the mainstream media continue to ignore the Christian problem here in the United States? According to the FBI, an estimated 1,382,012 violent crimes occurred nationwide in 2008, and 99% of those crimes were committed by Christians. In fact, Christians in the United States murdered over 14,000 Americans last year. Christians also committed close to 10 million property crimes against Americans last year. One of Christianity's major subsects, Catholics, are responsible for the majority of illegal immigration from Mexico into this country. Christian bankers on Wall Street have wrecked the economy. Last spring, a Christian terrorist drove around Dallas randomly shooting people on the freeways. Why is political correctness preventing the media from saying what we all know is true? That Christians in America pose a grave danger, and that you and your family are likely to be victims of Christian criminals sometime in your life. While many claim that Christianity is a religion of peace, hundreds of wars in the past 2,000 years have been started by Christians, and while gunpowder may have been discovered by the Chinese, just about every weapon of modern civilization has been developed by Christian scientists and engineers. There can be no doubt that Christians are responsible for just about everything that's wrong in America. I say, send them all back where they came from. Note, again, it's satire. On the other hand, this isn't. Now, as backstory, you remember that at their little tea party thing that they had to dummy up the footage about on Fox News and show Glenn Beck's larger but still not the hell not very large 9/12 rally, Fox had to insert 9/12 footage into their coverage of the teabagger rally because there just weren't enough teabaggers to go around to make it look like it was a big million teabagger march, right? And you'll recall that one of the signs there was a great big photographic description, a photographic depiction of stacked bodies at Dachau from the Holocaust and comparing that to what would happen to Merca if we was to get that socialized medicine. Some people, including many decent people such as myself, thought that that was rather sickening. And it was also criticized by people who actually know what the Holocaust was, which the teabaggers don't. Remember, they live in a world that they live in an America of their own imagination. Wow, there's a potential satire song. Not America the Beautiful, America the Imaginary. And one of the people who evinced something less than pleasure with seeing the Holocaust and the millions dead in it used for political gain by right-wing teabaggers who have more in common with the perpetrators of the Holocaust than with the victims thereof was Elie Wiesel, author of Night. I'm sure a lot of you have read Night. It is not an easy read, but it's something that probably everyone should read. Well, over at America Blog, John Aravosis posted a photograph of Elie Wiesel at Buchenwald. More than half starved. More than half naked. Bones showing through skin. It is tragic, of course. John Aravosis writes, Holocaust survivor and Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel criticized a teabagger protest in Washington, D.C. A protester who had held up a sign showing dead bodies from the Dachau concentration camp stacked in a pile and compared this to the Democrats' health care reform plan. Over at Politico, the teabaggers weighed in to share their thoughts on Wiesel's criticism. As follows.
Rothschild's nothing. Everyone knows that Obama is George Soros' sock puppet. Wasn't Soros Jewish once upon a time? May the Schwartz be with you.
Then there's this little nugget of tolerant beauty.
The Jews need to clam up and accept the fact that they're in a Christian country.
Then this.
This Holocaust thing,
that's Hollowcost,
this Holocaust thing is totally overblown by the Jewish.
And then this, and I think this must be a relative of the Moran guy.
Elie Wiesel should just go back to Indonesia. I don't see him condemning the terrorist shooter at Fort Hood.
But the beauty of morons, hateful though they may be, is that when they come out, you know, they don't just come out in force, and they don't just come out timid. They come out in the full flowering monstrosity of their manifest stupidity. Witness the following:
Elie is a whiner. She should stop her whining. You did not complain when the libs were calling Bush Hitler.
Yeah, she should stop her whining. You can't fix stupid.
You know what? The fact is that at a time in history, the Rothschild family controlled practically everything. This is a fact, not anti-Semitic. I respect the Jewish outrage at everything. I'm a Tea Partier. Obama is a Marxist and takes his orders from George Soros. It is similar, and these people need to get a life.
Imagine that, telling a Holocaust survivor to get a life.
Woo! Why any Jew would support the Obama administration is a mystery anyway. He is a Muslim sympathizer and the greatest threat to Israel ever to sit in the White House. Wake up, Jewish community. Take off the blinders. Ellie, how did that whole Madoff thing work out for you? Ellie Wiesel, newest, most current tool of the sick, perverted, racist, anti-Semitic Democrat Party. Have you no shame, Democrats? Most American Jews are not very religious, and many are outright unbelievers, Jews in name only. Many older Jews in America feel shame for being in America rather than immigrating to Israel in the late 1940s. Many sent money to help the colonization, and a few sent army surplus rifles, but the majority came up with the most interesting excuses for not answering the call to gather together and forge their homeland. Elie Wiesel is a disgusting PR-seeking, profiteering demagogue who's made a fortune off playing on the world's guilt trips about what happened to the Jews during World War II. Most objective WW2 researchers agree now that the bestial Nazis who happened to be anti-capitalist socialists...
Oh, God. Socialists.
Yeah. Killed even more Slavs and Gypsies in their concentration camps than Jews. But you don't see the Slavs and Gypsies trying to profit off the Holocaust like some of the shameless, powerful Jews in the media. You know, we don't need them to republish the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. It is sunk way in. Did you hear that? Prophet, shameless and powerful Jews in the media. God, that sounds like, that reminds me of Richard Nixon with that taped conversation with Billy Graham. Billy, we could really change things in America, but it's those Jews in Hollywood who keep, it's those damned Hollywood Jews. The Jews in the media. I sometimes wonder what has happened to the Jewish people. The Bible says that they are God's people and Israel is their homeland. I see so many Jews seem to have abandoned their faith, and I think this has to sadden our Father in heaven. I see many Jews that are homosexual actively promoting it as a normal lifestyle. I see many Jews involved in the ACLU, which I call the Anti-Christian Liberal Union. This bothers me as how can one be against their Father and Son in heaven who are for life? I see many Jews in Hollywood making filthy, sinful movies. What happened to the good family movies? I see many Jews full of greed in Hollywood, Wall Street, etc. I see many Jews... Boy, I tell you, this must be like the only Christian who lives in some, you know, Hasidic neighborhood. He just sees Jews. There's Jews everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, I went to a barbecue stand, and there were Jews. It was Jewish barbecue. There's Jews everywhere. Ah! I see many Jews involved in abortion groups. How can one support the killing of human fetuses, especially people who have suffered through the Holocaust? I'm not anti-Semitic. I love that you got to get two-thirds of the way through the paragraph of anti-Semitism before you get to I'm not anti-Semitic. I know many will come on here and attack me. I'm simply stating what I see, and I believe our Father in heaven is wondering what is happening to His chosen people. He sent His only Son to earth to die for our sins, and I think He's wondering the direction our country's taking? ? I am praying for our country and all the Jews in our country, and pray that our Father will forgive us for our sins. I'm sure that, oddly enough, just taking from the tenor of this note, I'm pretty sure that prayer doesn't include, Dear Father, please forgive me for actively advocating for the senseless slaughter of a million Iraqi civilians, or the anonymous hellfire missiling of various and sundry innocent Afghan wedding parties. No, that's not part of the prayer of the forgiveness. No, not sorry. I'm praying for our country and all the Jews in our country. Dear Jesus, please help all the Jews. And all the Jews in our country, and pray that our Father will forgive us all for our sins. I hope I have stated what God would have wanted me to say. God bless and pray for our country.
And then this about Elie Wiesel. Old man should go away. Old man should go away. I know. So again, maybe that's the theme that that sort of evolves and develops through the course of this evening. What's real ought not be. And what ought not be is. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
I heard a good other name for Fox News on Washington Journal this morning.
Oh, did you really?
I mean, you may have heard it, but I haven't, but I thought it was great. The White Power Network.
That's about the size of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was a great name. Don't you? White Power Network.
We're Fox, your white power, your white power news authority.
Yeah. And I had a thing that I got in behind. I was at the drugstore today, and I went up to stand in line, and there was looked like a fairly young guy, big husky guy, in front of me, and he and this woman was talking. When I got up there, I realized they were talking about the health care plan. And she went on, and he was saying, they were kind of talking to one another. She was still talking to him on the way out. And he said, yeah, we ought to be able to vote for that. They're trying to cram it down our throats. And then he said, well, I know one thing. He's not going to be a second term if he lives that long.
Whew.
They just say what they want to say, don't they?
Oh, yeah, they do. They absolutely do. And it's scary as heck.
I thought, in a way, I thought, maybe I ought to get his tag number and report him.
Well, that's like that freakazoid Karl Rove on Fox today.
Oh, gosh.
He was having an on-air hissy fit, namely this particular hissy fit. Hang on, I'll get it rolling here in just a second.
Carl, also during this Asian trip, the President of the United States had a very deep bow toward the Emperor of Japan. You know, this is a long-standing precedent going back to the founding of the Republicans. American presidents don't bow to anybody, but the president, there he is bowing. He bowed to King Abdullah earlier in the year as well. The administration said, look, it's just protocol. It's one of those things they do. You've been in an administration where a president has faced, there's Abdullah right there, it's going down. Why doesn't the, when you look at this, what do you think?
I think it was inappropriate. Look, you may, you know, a slight nod of the head perhaps to the Japanese emperor, though, you know, what's that all about? I mean, he's not even the head of state.
Right.
You know, but that deep bow for the waist, actually in the Japanese culture, bespeaks weakness. And look, the President of the United States simply can't get it right. I mean, it's a worldwide apology tour. We're sorry, we're wrong. And oh, incidentally, I'm going to bow deeply to the waist to you know, the once divine Japanese, you know, Japanese monarchy. I just don't get it. I mean, in England, they didn't bow, but they bow there. They bow to the Saudi, but, you know, will they bow to the king?
Do you just hate Karl Rove or what, Juanita? And I know you don't. I know you don't have hate in your heart, but
no. You know, I've been thinking about that lately. I've been rethinking that.
You know, the funny thing is that Karl Rove knows little or nothing about American history, because early on, I'm trying to think. I forget if it was Jefferson or George Washington who didn't think much of handshaking. And he just wanted a nice, crisp little bow at the waist, like, maybe George Washington was credited as having invented the handshake or something, but But the nerve for the nerve of Karl Rove.
Yeah.
To complain about how the President of the United States behaves with respect to the leader of another country when he, pardon me, I'm not trying to be crass, but George did everything but give the tongue to the King of Saudi Arabia. You know what I mean? Yeah, holy cow!
Well, I saw another version of that on the MSNBC, I believe, or and at least the people that were commentating did bring up that George Bush, about him kissing the, you know, the Emirate or whatever.
The King of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And they showed it, too. And I thought, well, my gosh, you know, first it was the hamburgers. Or maybe it was not the first. Remember, they had never heard of Have It Your Way, I guess. But of all things to talk about this now.
But you know, if they caught Obama making a ham sandwich, Juanita, there'd be something wrong with it. These people are pathetic.
Of course. Well, I can't win for losing. That's for sure. But for Karl Rove needs to shut his trap because.
Well, Karl Rove needs to be standing in a dock facing charges in The Hague.
Exactly right. Whole bunch of them, especially him and Cheney and Bush. They should be investigated, publicly investigated. Of course, now they got a thing, you know, about the prisoners from Guantanamo going up to Illinois. You know, to that prison.
Right.
Well, it's going to be dangerous for Illinois.
Oh, Illinois is just going to catch fire and burn to the ground.
Yeah.
They'll be bombing Walmarts all over the place trying to get...
They interviewed some people there, and they said they thought it would be good for them, you know, because the economy's really bad, and that it would bring back some economy to them, you know.
Right, but, you know, I kind of reject... I reject the idea of prison economies as being something fundamentally un-American.
Oh, well, that's another subject, yeah.
And moreover, there's the equally disturbing fact that what the people we're talking about warehousing at this Illinois prison, Juanita,
yeah,
may not, I mean, it's like something out of what Mr. Chi was talking about earlier in the program, just sticking somebody in prison without charges and never letting them go. There is, you can see the story at your SDP.org of someone who was a member of the Singaporean legislature who has simply been held in prison without charges for 27 years.
Oh, Lord.
Who's 82 years old. And what we're talking about doing is using that prison in Illinois as a warehousing facility for people who have never been charged.
Well, they want them to stay down in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're saying they're fussing about having trials in New York City. But it's funny to me how they say they should be tried by the military. Yet, that was their excuse not to give them the Geneva Convention handling because they weren't really military. So, I mean, it's crazy. That's their kind of crazy thinking.
Well, it isn't logical, Juanita, and I think maybe the best way to describe it is to say that it is circular thinking. Because on the one hand, you know, I was clicking by because it's the only daggum news channel I get. And on my way back from ESPN, where the sporting world was having a fit over a coaching call on fourth down last night in the Patriots Colts game, I happened by Fox News just in time to hear someone say, "Well, those people captured that are at Guantanamo, they're enemy combatants, just like the people who bombed Pearl Harbor." But of course, that's not true.
No.
Because enemy combatant is a newish term. and enemy combatant was not the designation for people that we captured in the course of the Second World War. The definition of people we captured in the Second World War was prisoner of war. And the Bush administration hair-lipped hell trying to keep from calling the people they captured prisoners of war, and that's how they came up with that Orwellian bit of nonsense, enemy combatant.
It's just, you know, the whole thing is just crazy as a bed bug.
It is.
Did you know that, just speaking of crazy, and that's an insult to crazy people, but Glenn Beck, speaking of that,
yeah.
You know South Park has got a thing on him now?
Oh, I've seen it.
Have you?
Yes.
Oh, I got to see it.
I'll have to look and see if I can find it. David in Tennessee sent that along, and that was... And they, you know, just like Jon Stewart did, South Park nailed him, too.
Yeah, I love Jon Stewart, too. And he's the one that exposed Fox News about that, and those people together.
Right. The film footage of the rallies.
It was just like the trees suddenly had gold leaves, and then they were green.
You just can't beat this. You can't beat this bunch. Well, I mean, you know, look, let's make sure. You know, I sort of issued a little bit of an indictment of Virginia Senator Jim Webb earlier in the program, talking about him co-sponsoring this. Let's make sure that mentally damaged people get guns, Bill. Mentally damaged veterans get guns.
Yeah.
With Burr of North Carolina, the Republican, and he's wrong on another one too. He doesn't want anybody tried in given a fair trial. He doesn't want anybody from Guantanamo to be given a fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
He said this. I have never disputed the constitutional authority of the president to convene Article III courts in cases of international terrorism. However, I remain very concerned about the wisdom of doing so. Those who have committed acts of international terrorism are enemy combatants just as certainly as the Japanese pilots who killed thousands of Americans at Pearl Harbor. It will be disruptive, costly, and potentially counterproductive to try them as criminals in our civilian courts. The precedent set by this decision deserves careful scrutiny as we consider it proper venues for trying those now held at Guantanamo who were apprehended outside of this country for acts that occurred outside of the country. And we must be especially careful with any decision to bring onto American soil any of those prisoners who remain a threat to our country but whose cases have been adjudged as inappropriate for trial at all. They do not belong in our country, they do not belong in our courts, and they do not belong in our prisons. I have consistently argued that military commissions, with the additional procedural rules added by Congress and enacted by President Obama, are the most appropriate venue for trying individuals adjudged to be enemy combatants. Enemy combatants is a made-up bunch of baloney.
Yeah. Well, I don't agree.
You don't agree with me or with Webb?
I don't agree with Webb.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, he's right. No, And that's that Pearl Harbor thing. They were enemy soldiers. They were enemy pilots.
Right.
They were enemy sailors.
I mean, you didn't have to have a trial to prove that.
No.
I mean, I was watching some World War footage last night. They've got some good ones on History Channel. And anyway... That, you know, they definitely had, I mean, we hardly had any fleet to fight with. Like they said, you had six carriers.
Three.
And they were like old.
Yeah, we had three. The Yorktown, the Enterprise, and the, or maybe the Enterprise, Hornet, and Wasp. We had three carriers in the Pacific. And they all happened to be out on patrol, out at sea at the time that Pearl Harbor happened, but they got all of our old battle wagons and old destroyers and old cruisers and, you know.
Yeah, everything that could, yeah, because most of the stuff was going to Europe. But I remember you telling about your uncle that died over in the Pacific. I always remember that story.
I had an uncle. I had an uncle and a great uncle. No, an uncle.
The one you said that he had a small wound. We were talking about.
Oh yeah, that was that was my father's brother. Yes.
Yeah, the great. Remember.
Mm-hmm.
scientists they had at those Band-Aids they had at the Republican convention.
Oh, yeah, the Purple Heart Band-Aids?
Yeah. And yeah. I was talking to you about, you know, just a tiny wound, can you can bleed to death from it. Just a little teeny one. You just hit a bleeder. And you said that if they'd have had some kind of maybe like penicillin, I don't know if that penicillin.
Right. Well, all the, yeah.
Whatever, so.
All the penicillin was with the the forces marching from Normandy eastward, whereas my uncle was on a, I guess it was a diversionary invasion in the south of France, and they got no penicillin, and I got no uncle.
Yeah. And, you know, about them making fun of, you know, the little wounds, and I thought, well, they're laughing at the something they don't have any comprehension about.
No, that's.
And then I talked to you about it, and then you told me about him, about your uncle.
Right.
I'll just remember that. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go and enjoy both of your interviews. It sounds to me like Ferg's got a deeper voice now.
Oh, he's working on it, yeah. That voice is deepening, but he's. But he also feels much more grown up when he's behind the microphone, so he tries to put it to use.
Oh, he's going to be good.
Oh, I hope. All we can do is keep working.
He is. He's at that, I think, that wonderful stage now. I love the boys when they're that age. I mean, you know, they...
I can send him to you for a little while.
Huh?
I can send him to you for a little while. Because sometimes it's not so wonderful around here. I hate you forever. You ruined my life.
He's something else. You're going to be proud of him, though.
Oh,
I know you are now.
I am now. I just...
Yeah. Yeah.
All you can do is hope. Hope and work.
Well, he'll have that foundation that you and Agnes gave him.
Well, thank you, Juanita. I do appreciate it. You have yourself a wonderful evening,
you
all right?
Too.
Hey, wait. I was going to ask you, has the Oprah interview with...
I saw it.
Did you see it?
I made myself watch it, yeah.
Did you have to, like, use toothpicks to force your eyelids open? And was it awful?
Well, it was mostly about, you know, her wonderful family, her wonderful husband, and about the beautiful children, and about how they... told her what to eat and what to wear, and she said she didn't have to pick out her clothes. They laid them out for her. I don't know. It was just a bunch of stuff about that, about how mistreated she's been.
Poor baby. She's been persecuted, hasn't
Katie.
She?
You know.
Oh, y'all. Is she still mad at Katie Couric?
Oh, yeah. But she's
Where's that Christian forgiveness?
I don't know, but she, I always remember what she said about Hillary when she first started. You know, something about Hillary was being attacked, and Hillary, you know, kind of got upset about it. And she said,
"Oh, was that where she said
to get over it?"
Yeah, and she needs to quit whining.
Yeah, quit whining. But that's okay for them. That's okay because they're the chosen ones. You know, she's probably part of that in a way too. Yeah, they're. I finally found out. Thanks to knowing about the family, why they it's okay for them and not for us.
Yeah?
Yeah, I made myself, I thought, yeah, I'm going to watch it, you know. It showed her going to exercise. She can really exercise.
Oh, the Juanita moment for the evening. Oh, she can really exercise.
Yeah. Well, she can shoot too, can't she?
Well, you got to stop. You got to stay in top shape when your husband's a champion snow machine racer, don't you know? And you exert all that energy shooting the wolves from the helicopters, Dad.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, Marty tells me it was Yorktown, Hornet, and Enterprise were the active carriers that weren't hit at Pearl Harbor.
It was what?
It was Yorktown, Hornet, and Enterprise that were the three carriers. That weren't there at Pearl Harbor that basically saved our bacon.
Oh, yeah. But they've got, if anybody has History Channel, they're having it every night, and a lot of people, it's things I've never seen before, and I've seen a lot, is people that were there, and last night they concentrated on Africa and the Pacific, not Okinawa, what was the one, Guadalcanal, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think that was the first one, wasn't it? And then Attu, that was one of the Alaskan islands. Those are the first two victories we had. But it showed a lot, you know, how the bodies were piled up and all the Japanese and the Americans all intermingled. And I remember I had an uncle that was over there, and I remember him telling about the horrific condition of the bodies, you know. But that was when they felt like they were deserted because they had left, and then finally they got some help. But, gosh, it's so amazing what people go through.
Well,
it's
horrific.
Really amazing. Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking one for the team, Juanita, and watching the the Oprah interview of Bible Spice, Caribou Barbie.
I wasn't planning on watching. I thought, well, why not? I'm just have to see. But it's a big seller.
Oh, gosh, yes. And you know, she's, well, I suspect that the first drafts of the book were written in crayon from what I'm reading, but you know, I'm mean. Juanita, have a wonderful evening.
Okay, you too.
All right, bye now. And let's see, 16 minutes past the hour, about 40 minutes of good conversation left in the program. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Brian from New Hampshire.
Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, I was wondering, is young Ferg there? Is he still hitting the tackle dummies?
No, that's football season's over.
Oh, okay.
And he didn't make the cut for basketball, so he's... Yeah, he was a little bummed out.
Sounds like he's a much better endeavor going there with the musical... It sounds like he's really already well ahead of that game.
It's a lot of fun to watch him because he's figuring stuff out on his own.
Right.
And he's got something. I mean, you know, I noodled around on a guitar for years, and I love the guitar, but I could never hear it. I didn't have an ear, so to speak, and he's got an ear like crazy, and he can hear it, and he can figure it out and start playing it.
That's great. You got musicians that. The best ones is see that I can go by Beethoven, and you know, he was some of his greatest music, of course, was when he was a blind and deaf.
I'm not sure about the blind part, but I know he wrote the ninth when he was deaf.
Yeah, and just incredible, soulful, most soulful music in the history of man. I would still say it, it was an interesting interview there. And I just, well, now you're Juanita, you know, I gotta say, to talk about her southern lilting, like a Mississippi stream under a William Faulkner novel, where it was moving along slowly compared to Brian on all his coffee, and your beautiful flowing, almost musical speaking, you know, what a gal, Juanita.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And
but I wanted to,
you know, I just love that she sure can exercise.
Braver than me too, and just stronger than me. Because Sarah, this is where I was going to call about. And your gentleman you had on before, your son was on there. The gentleman from Singapore. It brings us right back to Asia, and you're talking about Pearl Harbor there. There's a great book there too about. I mentioned it before. I think on your show, Bob. Was Pearl Harbor's ghost, and it tells about the Japanese American community there when the Pearl Harbor then Hawaii was still like a. U.S. Protectorate, or it was not a state yet until 1960. But the Japanese Americans there still, many of them used that term, that three letter term, and they were angry at the Japanese for the surprise attack, whatever it was, than most Americans were. And most of the home guard in Hawaii at that time were Japanese Americans. And the people that came over, they said, well, you couldn't believe what you're giving these J words, all these guns and all that, that looks like they've already conquered Hawaii. But the people didn't realize that was part of the great Hawaiian culture that invites all the diversity is a strength to Hawaiian culture. Barack Obama can tell us more about that. But the fact is, in Barack Obama, he was, before he went into China, he said to the worst dictatorship, I think even worse than Singapore, the Burmese dictatorship, he told them they should free Aung San Suu Kyi. She's freely elected by 80% of the vote. She's been Compare her to Sarah Palin, Bob. She's like a Pallas Athena of democracy. She truly is. Aung San Suu Kyi is. She's a great book she wrote there, Freedom from Fear and Other Writings, came out in 1989. She was put under house arrest after she won the election there in 1990. But the fact is, to compare, it's like a, they're like the you know, you're talking about the Elie Wiesel book, Night. It's like comparing the evil night that he went through today to what she hopes for peaceful democracy for the Burmese people, of this great lady, Aung San Suu Kyi stands for. She's lost her English husband there because he died while she's been under the house arrest there. And she's given up her life for her country. She's the daughter of the founder of modern Burma. There's such a difference in what the American media tries to bring out. I don't know where it is, but say they're trying to make something virtuous out of this overgrown, immature, backstabbing girl, really, that Sarah Palin, when there are so many qualified Republican women out there that they could go to. This is ridiculous. I can't believe Oprah had her on. Hello?
Yeah, well, I think, no, I don't see a purpose in Oprah having her on unless Oprah has some sense of fundamental fairness or something like that.
Yeah.
But she has nothing to offer.
You talk about the real, this book there, Freedom from Fear, the real moral person there. She believes in Theravadan Buddhism, that Aung San Suu Kyi does, but she's an Anglophile, you know, from the history of Burma, and then she married her English husband. But when she was going to Oxford in 1964, St. Hugh's College in Oxford, as a freshwoman there, this lady, as she wrote the epilogue to the book there, Ann Pasternak Slater was one of her classmates there, and they were talking to her, Aung San Suu Kyi, about why, you know, the sexual freedom, the sexual revolution was just coming into vogue there in England and America, you know, and they were just saying, one bold girl asked Suu Kyi, but why don't you want to sleep with someone? And back came the indignant reply from Aung San Suu Kyi, no, I'll never go to bed with anyone except my husband. Now I just go to bed hugging my pillow. And it raised the storm of mostly derisive laughter from the other girls there. This is a truly moral human being. And then you got an egotistical, you know, just fascist-loving corporatist like, you know, like Sarah Palin. In contrast, you know, why aren't they, you know, Barack Obama himself, he's come out with a couple of good statements there lately, and I don't, that's the tradition, to bow before the Japanese emperor. You know, even the American Caesar there by William Manchester about Douglas MacArthur. Bob,
yes, I've read it.
You know, he occupied, when he first took over Japan, you know, in the late 1945 and early 46, in the first few months, he made a point of not bowing before the emperor because he wanted not to be cruel to the Japanese people, not to be disrespectful to their culture. This was an incredibly brave people there. The history tells us they, because of our fear of casualties, the actions by these incredibly brave Japanese almost forced the American leaders to drop at least one or the two bombs, atomic bombs, on the Japanese nation. You can argue that back and forth, but the fact is, MacArthur, when he came in there in late 1945, he did not bow, but he was very, you know, generous and very polite to the emperor. But he wanted to show the Japanese people that this is just a human being. He's flesh and blood like the rest of you people, and they did have a growing, burgeoning democracy like the Weimar Republic in Germany before World War II was, you know, really broke out. The Japanese people were building their own democratic state. We had to do, I still believe it was the last good war, but when MacArthur came in there to occupy Japan, in late 45, early 46, he did not bow at that photo opportunity there with the emperor, but when he left, you know, after Truman fired him at the end of the Korean War there, towards the end, when Truman fired MacArthur, when he came back through Japan there before he went back to America, he did, I believe, he met with the emperor again. I think it's in the Manchester book, too, that he did bow before the Japanese emperor then, before he left Japan.
Well, but, the innate...
The famous generals, especially, but especially a famous general like MacArthur, their egos are much bigger than most presidents have ever been.
Oh, without a doubt. And the fact of the matter is, we don't even have to go that far into history, Brian.
Yeah.
My God in heaven, you've got that holding hands walking through the bluebells moment with Bush and the King of Saudi Arabia. Holy mackerel. You've got active kissing going on there.
That's the absolute homeland of Al Qaeda, Saudi Arabia, and you know they're just and one thing, and then Pakistan is still that's the one thing I agree with the former head of the unofficial lies infested official 911 commission there, former Governor Keene of New Jersey there, where he said Pakistan, in some interview there, they were going over the huge gaping holes in the so-called relationship to scientific truth and human truth that's in the official 911 report there. But Thomas Keene said that Pakistan's the most dangerous nation on earth. But I believe Barack Obama, about a week ago, didn't he say to the, he surprised everyone when he said to McChrystal and all of them, McChrystal, he's a political appointee, McChrystal is. In the American military, he's never had that kind of history. But he's a political appointee. He ran at least a part of then Vice President Cheney's assassination squads. McChrystal was part of that. Obama said straight to him in his face, and to the other plans there, supposed plan, you know, come back with another plan that has, that's a real plan that has an exit strategy for Afghanistan. And that's encouraging from Obama. I don't know if he can, the military industrial complex is so strong though, I'm not sure if he can sustain this with them, but that's still an encouraging sign.
It is encouraging, but yeah. it's still a long way from what we need. Because what we need is out of there, and you and I both know that.
That's right. It's just that what we're doing is basically making more enemies for the long term insecurity of America, and that's how the first September 11th attacks happened in the first place. And then you had the totally unqualified man who wouldn't listen to eight full months of warnings from basically every other intelligence agency on the planet and every other political leader on the planet that Al Qaeda was targeting, and this August 6, 2001 memo says, that the Al Qaeda operatives are, that when you can read through all of it, they were casing federal buildings in New York City and Washington, especially the World Trade, or they were saying the World Trade Center in New York City specifically. And this guy, then he says to the CIA guy, that, okay, you covered your butt, now get out of here. And then George Jr. goes fishing the rest of the day on August 6, 2001. And that, some of the Republicans are just chomping on the bit, hoping for, they don't care if it's a false flag terror attack or a real attack or what. They're ready to jump on and blame this young president when they let this guy get away with 8 months of full warnings. And he knew about that they were going to use planes for bombs. He was in Genoa in July.
Right,
July 2001, they had the anti-aircraft batteries all over there, and he had to sleep in a ship there off the...
Right, no one could... Yeah, what did kind of Sleazy Rice say?
Yeah.
No one could have imagined they'd use planes... Right, exactly.
That's right.
But...
I want to add real quickly that I'll let you go to some other caller there, Bob, but talking about those teabaggers with their National Socialist nonsense. I've read that, talk about a real horror story. I've read it. Elie Wiesel's Night is one of the most horrifying books, maybe the most horrifying book I've ever read.
And should be required reading.
It should be.
I can't think of anybody who doesn't need to read Night.
But to these teabaggers and these right-wing thinkers put that in huge quotes there, talk about Hitler's fascist right-wing corporatist Germany. You talk about the guy who barely got away with his life there, Albert Speer, who ran the economy of Adolf Hitler for years, from at least 1938 onward there. He was the ultimate corporatist and company man, and really a free market, he was a follower of that type of corporatist free market discipline. And he was, it had nothing to do with socialism, as you would say, as Marxism, and certainly not the, it was on its own right-wing way, the left-wing evil of Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union. But at the same time, the Soviet Union, for 4 years, Bob, 1949 to 1953, Joseph Stalin had a nuclear bombs, the Russians did, and we had stability then through the Truman and then the Eisenhower presidencies. Could we have ever trusted Adolf Hitler for even one day with such a weapon?
Oh, no.
My God. I mean, to compare them, it's like Churchill said, if Hitler had invaded hell, I would sign up a treaty of an alliance with the devil himself to compare, because it was somebody far more sane, at the least. And Joseph Stalin, like I said, he's like a, he came from the outlying areas of his empire, Russia. He was a Georgian and Turkic ancestry. He was a Georgian monk. It's like Napoleon came from Corsica. Hitler came from Austria. These came from the outlying areas of their empires or their cultures, and yet they took over when the people, they were lost and looking for someone on a white horse, and they instead got the evil difference in that, the polar opposite of that, and that's what scares me about the conveniently ignorant American people. They might look to some photogenic person like a Sarah Palin, or, you know, name some other that Sanford in South Carolina as being a person on the white horse that can save them, when their own Republican policies themselves is what got us.
Brian, did you catch the Godzilla from Wasilla's Facebook comments about the idea of trying these guys in New York City in federal court? She wrote the other day, if we are stuck with this terrible Obama administration decision, I, like most Americans, hope that Mohammed and his conspirators are convicted. Hang them high. So, in other words, she wants a nice, fair trial, and then she wants him executed.
Right. Yeah, that's really...
Is it just me, Brian, or can... I mean, does this have the stench of fascism about it?
And then, you know, this is a woman, like I say, she loves to mass murder the poor wolves there of Alaska, and that's her surname, like I say, the Palin surname is from the Celtic Phelan. It means people of the wolf. And there's a certain huge irony there, and it's like so many ironies you can bring out with Republicans and these so-called free market types. And that's what one of their greatest followers of that corporatist model there was Albert Speer, the economic czar of the Nazism during World War II for Adolf Hitler.
You want some more irony? Here's some for you. It turns out, and I guess this will start another right wing the firestorm of self-righteous indignation. It turns out that the New Oxford American Dictionary's Word of the Year has been released.
Okay. That's a great book.
And the New Oxford American Dictionary Word of the Year is unfriend.
Unfriend.
It's a verb. To unfriend is to remove someone from a friends list on a social networking site. But, and here's where the self-righteous indignation on the right comes in, because they just hate this. One of the finalists for the New Oxford American Dictionary Word of the Year was teabagger. Now, if we can just find some way to hang Cleveland Steamer on the right wing, I think we've got them done.
I think you know this, Bob. Well, if you listen to talk radio at all, that any liberal talk show where they're opened, and that our great gay citizens and our great that they've been through so much, that damn marriage amendment in California, Governor Schwarzenegger should be even more have an advocate for gay marriage for their right. But the fact is that term teabagger has something to do with, I believe, it's a gay sexual practice.
Well, it doesn't necessarily. I don't think it has to be gay itself. It's just the way. That, yeah. or maybe it does. I'd probably need to stay away from. Yeah, but it's a sexual practice. But the thing is, they have no one to blame but themselves, because it goes back to February. And in February, when the teabagging movement started, a guy named Dave Weigel from the Washington Independent took a picture of a protester at one of the early teabag parties, right. And the protester's sign said, "Teabag the liberal Dems before they teabag you." They became teabaggers, you know, by their own admission.
That's right, they did. But you know, that can have a double meaning, Bob.
Oh, sure it can. Absolutely.
And I'm not that much of a headcap with the gay scene there, but it's just there's so much irony with these people there that I can see why Jon Stewart has such a joyride sometimes with satirizing them.
Well, it practically writes itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But you know, that's just great political. That's just great political signage in the same hallowed tradition of Dick Nixon before he dicks you.
Yeah, because like the Boston Tea Party, our founding patriots. I don't remember. Did they ever use the term teabagger?
No.
No, I don't. I didn't think they did.
No. No, they just dressed up like Indians and chucked some stuff in the harbor because they didn't want to carry the tax, but they didn't want to carry the tax burden for the war that the British Crown had just waged in their behalf, the French and Indian War. That's what the tea tax was about. It was about getting the colonies to pay their own way for the French and Indian War.
Right. Oh, and to me, it remains the ultimate version of taxation without representation. Remains to me in the history of America is that they keep getting away with it. George W. Bush Jr. too, stealing the annual Social Security American Workers Social Security annual surplus trust fund amount, and that's talk about taxation without representation. But these right wing and these tea baggers and the so called conservatives never dare stand up to George W. Bush about that. They never dared.
All of this indignation is stuff that we were howling about for 8 years under George Bush that they just happened to notice. I mean, the re-education camps and the FEMA camps where we're going to stuff all the right-wingers and Obama's got them building prisons. These dumbasses didn't happen to notice that those prisons, and they really do exist, some of them. There's one in Indiana and another one elsewhere. They were built under George Bush. And then there's this, I don't know if you saw it or not, Brian, but again, back to the dumbass Sarah from Alaska. She was invited to Wisconsin last week or the week before where she gave a speech, and of course, no cell phones, no cameras. I hardly think notebooks and pens were allowed in there. It was total information lockdown.
Right. It's the same with it, what they allow these, there was the guy Comstock or whatever the guy's name right up here in New Hampshire for that town hall meeting there on health care. And then the two guys in Arizona where they're carrying firearms openly. The Secret Service should have detained them or at least taken the firearms until the president left. That's got nothing to do with that. That's Secret Service practice by
protocol,
law.
Sure.
They should have done.
Well, I was going to say what happened in Wisconsin, though, is that somebody did slip in with at least a notebook and reported that Sarah got all... righteously indignant. They're so good at it. And she complained. She said, "And what's this going on with these new coins? These new dollar coins where they've pushed In God We Trust off to the edge of the coin. Who ever heard of such a thing? I don't know what socialist it is that was ordering that."
Yeah.
Only problem was, Brian, the socialist who authorized the dollar coin with In God We Trust on the edge was... Well, it was George W. Bush.
She doesn't mention that. Or she wouldn't.
Oh, she doesn't know it.
She doesn't know it. I guess that's for sure. And, you know, talking about and the security difference from the Obama.
She's the babe in a bubble, you know.
Yeah, I remember it during the George Bush regime too. During I think he was traveling somewhere to speak around there. It's up near where the Microsoft computer people are there up in Washington somewhere. It's a very well-off neighborhood. And there's some elderly lady there had a sign there that, you know, love America, impeach George W. Bush, there's something like that. And while they were driving by, this elderly lady there, a poor old lady with her little sign there, the Secret Service had the locked-on semi-automatic rifles or assault guns or whatever they are, assault rifles, point it right at this poor woman as they drove by.
Ish.
I mean, this is the, you know...
We got a roll here, but I wanted to share one last piece of information with you because I know that you've described yourself from time to time, Brian, as a recovering Catholic.
Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. No, don't get me on this. I don't even respect... I don't recognize him as the Pope, even this former Hitler Jugend lad there.
Well, I've got one for you, yeah. that you're gonna you remember of course that the U.S. Council of Catholic
Polish guy there.
Yeah, the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops decided to become to dictate American legal policy.
Yeah.
And lawmaking a couple of weeks last week with the or week before last with the Stupak Amendment.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? They're doing it again.
And just
this time it's the Archdiocese of Washington D.C.
My God.
And this story goes back a few days. It goes back to last Thursday. Lottie in the chat room clued me into this. The story is up at the network website, headonradionetwork.com.
Just wait,
okay. Because you're going to hate this.
Okay.
The Catholic Archdiocese of Washington has put a knife to the neck of Washington, D.C. government. Because the Archdiocese has told Washington, D.C. government that it will be unable to continue social service programs in the district if the city does not knuckle under and change a proposed same-sex marriage law. The Archdiocese says that it's afraid that it might have to extend employee benefits to same-sex married couples or something awful like that. Susan Gibbs is the spokeswoman for the Archdiocese, and she said, if the city requires this, we can't do it. The city is saying in order to provide social services, you need to be secular. For us, that's really a problem.
That they have no right to be dictating that kind of thing about about such matters in the secular world there, about just as a Catholic relief service or those kind of things. They do what the original Prince of Peace was supposed to, you know. You
right, well, Catholic Charities serve 68,000 people in D.C.
Yeah.
And in order to maintain their institutional bigotry,
yeah,
the Catholic Church is saying that it will hang 68,000 people out to dry.
I know. And the same right wingers that where they're supporting this, the same right wing new pope there, this Pope Benedict, this is the same guy who, when he was a cardinal, was hiding and sending off to other obscure third world countries all of these alleged priests, these child molesting criminals. He was harboring them and sending them off to some safer location away from possible legal procedures. And the fact is, at the same time, he's telling American Catholics, don't you dare vote for John Kerry. You're not a Catholic then, because he's pro-choice.
Right, and now they're doing it. Now they're doing it to Patrick Kennedy in Rhode Island.
Oh God.
As I noted last week, the Archbishop of Rhode Island has said he's not sure. I mean, can you imagine saying this about a Kennedy?
Yes.
He's not sure that Patrick Kennedy's really Catholic.
To say that to a Kennedy, my God, they're amongst the most compassionate political families, you know, famous families in the history of this country.
And you can't get much more devoutly Catholic either.
No, that's right. Well, I'll let you go, Bob. You're a devoutly supporter of the secular faith we call the American Constitution. I'll always respect you for that.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's been a wonderful conversation. You have a good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye now. That's Brian from New Hampshire, and onward we roll. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I just thought I'd call and congratulate you. You did a wonderful, wonderful program on the 10th.
Oh, well, thank you.
About the health care. So I've been turning everybody on to it. Bravo to you.
Well, thank you so very much. Yes, I do appreciate it.
So angry about the Catholic Church that I want to start a petition to take their tax exemption away from them.
I don't see how they can maintain it. I honestly don't. I mean,
can help them get rid of it, I will.
You know, if you want to play politics, you don't get to be tax exempt.
Exactly.
You know, otherwise, you know, mind your own business and welcome to your tax free life. but that's the way it is with the right wing. They want their cake, and they want to eat it, too. And they don't just want their cake and eat it, too. They want our cake, too.
Exactly.
And I still don't know how the Southern Baptists feel about having the Roman Catholic Church dictate policy for them, because, or the United Church, or not the United, but the Church of Christ, the Southern version, you know, rabid Catholic haters, all of them. And yet nobody's managed to turn the light on for him and explain to him what's going on. It's, well, politics makes strange bedfellows, I suppose.
They may get it pretty soon.
One hopes. Well,
anyway, yeah, it was a great program. I've listened to it and almost wore it out.
Well, you let me
like really on a roll.
Well, you let me know if the electrons start wearing thin, and we'll get you a fresh copy.
Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know that was wonderful. I turned some friends on to it, and hopefully we'll get it to other people.
Well, I really would appreciate it if you do, because you know that's how we've built this over time, is just word of mouth. We've run some ads over at Bart Cop once in a while, but beyond that, everything that's happened here has been word of mouth, and it's been a beautiful thing, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, like I said, it was I mean, I've heard you on other stuff, but boy, you were just right on top of everything.
Well, it's,
I thought that was really good.
Well, it's gratifying to hear, and I really appreciate knowing that. Well, it's just one of those little reminders that what we're doing here matters, and there's no reason to be doing this if, you know, without responses like this, there's no reason for this to be happening.
I want to do a petition, but or find a petition to take back their tax exemption. And I was born and raised Catholic myself, but I, like you, don't think any religion should dominate everybody else.
Well, I don't, you know,
to an argument with a relative about it last night. But her issue was that she didn't want to pay for somebody else's abortion. I didn't know that they paid for them anyway, to be honest with you.
Well, that's the whole thing. The Hyde Amendment is there. What they're doing is they're extending right-wing religious dogma with the Stupak Amendment. And, of course, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but now now Bart Stupak has come out and said, well, if you leave us behind or if you take that out, there won't be no health care. I mean, this little religious bigot is holding the very lives, in the name of God, he is holding the very lives of 45,000 Americans per year in his bigoted hands and willing to kill them over his strange religious convictions.
And I'm one of the 45,000. I'm very seldom in my life had health insurance. Very seldom.
Well, have you made your feelings known to his office?
Oh, I could do that without a problem.
Because you are in Michigan, aren't you?
I sure am.
Yeah. See, I thought that I seem to recall you being a Michigander, and he needs to hear from people inside his state and inside his district, because. I can't imagine that Michiganders are, you know, by and large that narrow as to that narrow-minded as to want to impose. I mean, what if we came along and offered a bill that imposed our religious or irreligious leanings? Yeah, they would. You know, they'd have they would wet themselves.
You're right.
So. But then again, that's their problem, isn't it? They are forever looking to pluck the mote out of our eyes, oblivious to the beam that resides in their own.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, that Southern Baptist upbringing it comes rushing back at all the worst times.
Oh, no, it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
I just can't.
Everybody that's heard your, that I've turned on to you, in fact, I sent it to Congressman Conyers, one of his office employees.
Oh, my goodness.
And told her to listen to it. I mean, it was beautiful. I listened to it two or three times before I got to turn another friend on to it, and she never heard you before, and she thought it was great. And then, so I, in order to get it to people, I cut it into pieces. It took me 8 pieces to get it to people, but, and I was up very late last night doing it.
Oh, that's, what a lovely display of conviction. I hope they get as much out of it as you did. And I really thank you for the effort.
Well, that's no problem, because we're all in the same boat. But yeah, I don't.
Yeah, and it's got leaks in it, and we're bailing like crazy, aren't we?
I will call him and give him a piece of my mind, because, and in fact, the one friend that I told you really liked the whole spiel that you went through, was telling me that if you look at a map of Michigan, that really the only liberal or democratic area is right down here in the Detroit area where we're at. And the rest of it's all red.
Oh, knuckle walkers.
Yeah, it's mostly everywhere but outside of, you know, the Detroit area, the southeast area of Michigan. But, you know, hopefully they'll wake up. I've been trying very hard.
And I appreciate it.
I don't know how they can...
But you're doing the only thing that a responsible person can do. Because if we see this evil transpiring and we don't do anything about it, then we've participated in it.
Yeah, that's something I don't intend to do.
You know, the only thing, what is it? The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing?
Yep.
You know, sitting on the the other side's not sitting on the sidelines. They're in the game. And the whole trick to all of this is getting the rest of it in it, rest of us in it too. I have to roll on because we're near show's end, but it's so good
all to
hear from you, and I'm so glad to know that it did something for you.
No, it did. It put some fire in me.
All right. Well, don't be a stranger. Chime in anytime.
All right.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
It is about 8 minutes before the hour, and I don't want to go without just putting a little audio out there of something beautiful. The teabaggers got, no other word for it than punked. The teabaggers got punked by people who got into their teabag rally and actually in Minnesota and actually managed to get on the agenda to speak to the assembled, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking faithful. You're going to love this. Come on. Now, bear in mind, this is about them illegal immigrants, okay? Having a fit that, you know, once they get done with health care, they're going to go on and have a fit about the brown people, right?
Really excited to be here. People like all of you and events like this that make America great.
Yeah.
So give yourselves a round of applause, everyone.
Yeah.
I just want to talk about a couple of things this afternoon because I love this country and I want America to be the best place it can be. Mr. Gutierrez is getting ready to propose an immigration bill in just a few short days. And we have to make sure he knows that we want a bill that's tough on immigration. Now is the time for us to stand up and make our voices heard. In Minneapolis, where I'm from, we have a huge immigrant population that's been causing a number of problems. With the economy in recession and so many people getting laid off and unable to find work, immigrants should not be competing for the few jobs that are out there. It's just not fair to folks who have a claim to this country and a right to be here. All across America, they're contributing to the flooding of our job markets, making it hard for Americans to find jobs. Well, I'm fed up, and it's time to let our politicians know that enough is enough, and we're not going to take it anymore. We need to secure our borders to protect this country. We need to restore order and put an end to the anarchy that's sweeping the nation. We need tougher immigration laws to make sure that we send these people back where they came from.
We need to protect the sovereignty of real Americans.
Yes. Yeah.
We need to hold our politicians accountable.
Yeah.
It's no secret that with the invasion of immigrants comes waves of crime. It's even involved in massive theft and murder and bringing diseases like smallpox, which is responsible for the death of millions of Americans. These are new problems, though. They've been going on for hundreds of years. They continue to this day. It's time for us to say enough is enough. Are you with me?
Enough is enough.
All right. Let's send these European immigrants back where they came from. Crimes in the history of the world. We're talking about genocide and slavery. I want more workplace rights, starting with the big bankers downtown. Those illegals are hiding out of their offices, stealing Dakota people's jobs. Let's round them up and ship them out. We need to hit them at home where they sleep. I don't care if we separate their families because they came here illegally. That's right. Anyways. So if we aren't able to stand up to these European immigrants, who can we stand up to? We need to send every one of them back home right now. That's right, for the Dakota people, not for European immigrants. They stole the land from genocide and ethnic cleansing. All right, thank you very much, and we'll see you in the streets. Columbus, go home! Columbus, go home! Columbus, go home! Columbus, go home!
Columbus, go home. Oh, that's good. That's good. I don't care if they're English or Irish or Polish or Italian or Norwegian. Gotta send them back. They're such simple, yet dangerous fools, aren't they? Hang them high. Thanks, Sarah. And that's it for the program tonight. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed sharing it with you. Make sure you join us again tomorrow night. And tell your friends, tell your neighbors. This only grows by word of mouth. I'm going to close with a quick story. Nah, I'll save it for another night. There's not enough time. But we'll hit the ground running again tomorrow night. Thanks to all of you. Thanks for your kind, continued support. It's the only thing that keeps us going. It is the 16th of November. We haven't hit $1,000 yet. We're a long way from it. We try to raise $2,000 a month. We're halfway through November. We're not even halfway there. If you can hit the PayPal button, it's much appreciated. Or if you can use the snail mail address, that is equally effective. Thanks to John Fox, Peter Godbold, Ben Birch, Sue, Lottie, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Hope to be hearing back from Susan real soon. She's away for a bit. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. I've got a story that'll probably make it into tomorrow's stack about anti-Americanism among America's corporate coal elite that I think you want to maybe participate in. Have a wonderful evening, or morning, or commute, or however it is you listen to this program. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Bye.
show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Monday. Beautiful Monday. Merciful Monday. Monday has arrived. It's another brand new week of liberal media on the horn. And aren't you happy? I'm happy. Of course, last night was something very, very special. Ferg and I enjoyed an absolutely magnificent time down in Charleston. Him getting his first rock concert. Me, my first trucker show in myself. Had a lovely conversation with Patterson Hood after the show. And Ferg was on something that you've heard of. He was on Cloud 9. No. Ferg was on something that takes a lot more than simple math to calculate. And he and I will talk about it here in a little bit. We've also got something that I hope is going to work out and happen coming up about the bottom of the hour. And that is that we've got a guest coming along. And it's going to be one of those little groundbreaking international conversations that we've become so fond of. We're going to be joined at the bottom of the hour by Chi-Soon Won. Chi-Soon Won is a political dissident in one of the harshest, most repressive regimes on earth, namely Singapore. Of course, President Obama just recently further legitimized Singapore's repression by attending the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit there. And I really do have to thank the Singaporeans for not putting President Obama in a pagliacci suit or the little dotted pajamas that somebody put George Bush in. These were simply little silk tunics of varying muted colors. And it's, well, I'm just grateful. But that's about as far as my gratitude extends. Singapore is a magnificent place. A beautiful place, an amazing food culture, a culture that represents a emerging an amalgam of just about all the it's kind of a crossroads for all the ethnicities of the Asian region, and in that place there is a government as repressive, as I said, as any on the planet. Chi-Soon Won has been jailed frequently. He has been harassed. He has been driven into bankruptcy. All because he had the unmitigated gall to challenge the ruling elite and its leader, Lee Kuan Yew. Now, by the way, Lee Kuan Yew was recently welcomed into the Oval Office. Let's see. Who agrees with me? Well, let's see. Amnesty International does. The legal system there has been condemned by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch. And if you can imagine, because of the fact that he dares to criticize the government, Chi-Soon Won is not allowed to leave the country. If you say something bad about the government in Singapore, you are sued for defamation and driven into bankruptcy. As Chee Soon Juan and his Singapore Democratic Party have been done. Among other things, it has been said that this climate continues to stifle freedom of expression, deters the expression of views alternative to those of the ruling People's Action Party, and dissuades many Singaporeans from exercising their right to take part in public affairs. This is, well, this is less than inspiring, and I rather wish that we wouldn't legitimize it. Because, you know, we had 8 years, did we not? 8 tormented, tortured, agonizing, misspent years of the Bush administration running brutally around the planet, supporting dictatorships, supporting repressive regimes. Wouldn't it be good to sort of turn that around? I mean, just saying. But no, they were legitimized. I hate that. Something else that came out of, and this is distressing, something else that came out of the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit meeting. We've decided to punt on climate change. Let's see. Yesterday, in the NFL, New England coach Bill Belichick decided not to punt, and it cost him. There are times you should punt. But we have decided, when we ought not, to punt on climate change. The language specifically from the New York Times is as follows, Dateline Singapore. President Obama and other world leaders have decided to put off the difficult task of reaching a climate change agreement at a global climate conference scheduled for next month, agreeing instead, oh, those insteads, those are the ones that bite you in the ass, aren't they? Instead, to make it the mission of the Copenhagen conference, Copenhagen, to reach a less specific, politically binding agreement that would punt the most difficult issues into the future. See, I didn't say punt. They said punt. And that's the New York Times. A less specific, politically binding agreement that would punt the most difficult issues into the future. Apparently, there was a hastily organized breakfast there at the APEC summit Sunday morning. And it was attended by folks like Lars Loke Rasmussen, the Prime Minister of Denmark, and the chairman of the climate conference in Copenhagen. And he and others agreed that in order to salvage the meeting at Copenhagen,